Go ahead and call this regular meeting of Havana County Board of Supervisors to order. We'll stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Go ahead and move on to the County Administrator's Report. Mr. Nichols.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Just a few things, a lot of fun updates, actually. We do want to remember that Mrs. Booker's birthday is Friday.
Yay.
And she's going to buy us all a present. So.
She's going to be an old lady, right?
I'm not saying that. Mr. Chester said that, Mrs. Booker.
I know.
I can.
So a few things. I just want to really thank the community who came together, the board who supported, and then Aaron Spitzer, who kind of sponsored the Under 12 Football League. They really had a great season this year. They didn't do a lot of postseason things as they'd planned, but at least they got the season kicked off and they did a full season of games. This is an example of the pictures that moms and dads got for their kids that were participating with the team pictures and individual, and just a really nice program. And it didn't cost the full $19,000 that was obligated. We'll give you a report on that afterwards, partly because of the number of kids involved, and partly because there was just some cost savings. And so we'll give you a full report on the league as after they've gotten their records finalized. But anyway, it's a great year, and the kids had a lot of fun. Mr. Custer and a variety of other citizens, you know, really did a good job with that. You've seen the new signage around Palmyra. If you haven't, hadn't noticed, it's new. It replaces the old signage that wasn't there. And so now we have signage, and so you can find buildings. It's really great. The Public Works Department did a good job, but
really
Mr.
Nice.
Newman, I don't recall him, but he was before my time, but Mr. I think Ed Newman mm-hmm. worked in the Public Works
yes.
Department. He's one that did the original designs, right. And Mr. Stevens found some of those designs, and they mm-hmm. piggybacked off of that, so we're going to try to send him a note of thanks because it's kind of come to fruition. You'll see similar signs at other buildings. They're already at the Sheriff's Office and Library. But it'll be at Parks and Rec and down at Carriagebrook for the social services buildings too, as we go forward with the program. So, nice
additions. Mr. Newman, didn't they move out of?
I think they're in New Mexico. I've
yes.
heard.
Yes. Yeah. And he wanted to contribute all of his materials mm-hmm. that he made those. And they did them at home. Mm-hmm. Did computer. Right. Deandra
right.
Strong was a teacher and assistant.
Right.
Was his wife, and I don't know what they did with the
Well, that's what Mr. Stevens found.
That.
He found a lot of those old drawings and old mm-hmm. Items that were used and used that kind of as
right.
a baseline to start with this. So
yeah,
that's good. But anyway, so we'll try to track him down.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
The DEQ monitors our landfill, you know, the closed landfill, and they come out periodically. One of the things they found on the last inspection is because of earth movement and trees growing and shrubs, they couldn't find the benchmarks, the actual markings for land locations, for identifying the specific locations around the landfill. And we appreciate the help of Scott Miller and Roger Black. Both went out there and did a lot of yeoman's work to find these. And now we have them identified with a different kind of post that's up elevated above the ground. Because all these are steel posts in the ground with a yellow cap, except that in any yard, you're going to lose that unless you've got some big thing there. So they've taken care of that, and that satisfies DEQ requirements too. So good work by those guys. The Eagle Scouts, I didn't get a picture of this one, unfortunately, but there's a brand new bridge on the trail behind the library, a really nice bridge. We got some donated timbers, telephone poles from Dominion, or from CVEC, I believe. I shouldn't say Dominion in the same sentence with Central Virginia Electric Cooperative, but they donated telephone poles, but it's a really nice bridge that's for people, hikers, bikes, horses. It's really nice over across the creek behind the library. And really good job by a scout doing an Eagle Scout project. Halloween had lots of events at both the library and the Parks and Rec did at the Pleasant Grove. And so you'll see a few of these scary creatures that were out there that night. Had a lot of fun back at the pole barn and some interesting hay rides with a lot of scared parents when it got off the hay ride. It was pretty cool. Lots of lights and kids running around and scary things in the dark, and the families had a lot of fun. These are the winners from the costume contest. I don't know how you can look at that stuff and not be smiling, but anyway, there's the 0-3, the 4-6, the 7-9. The little 7-9-year-old robot, took him about 20 minutes to get from the Pleasant Grove house to the pole barn, because he was walking stiff-legged the whole way. And then the 10-12-year-olds. Also, is Mr. Smith there? Who did the FUMA Interact Club do the
FUMA shop class?
Shop class. So these, you can't see them very good in this picture, but these are wooden cutouts in the shape of a pumpkin, and it says like scary first,
spooky second.
These were the trophies that the kids got for their first, second, third place stuff that young men did at FUMA and created and painted and then decorated, and that's what the trophies were for the kids. It was really cool. So a lot of good things going on in our county. Trail work behind the library a couple weekends ago, putting some new berms and some new water runoffs to help the trail from degenerating, to get the water runoff into the woods rather than down the trail. And that trail's actually got some pretty steep runs on it. And so one of the gentlemen brought his own personal tractor out to help do that. And then we had 8 or 10 volunteers out there.
Awesome.
And some good donuts. Carolyn Richardson, I just talked to her a little while ago. She did such a good job with this. She's done a father and daughter dance before, but she did a mother-son Halloween dance. This was kind of the inaugural event, and a lot of help from community volunteers and community partners. But you can see how much fun the moms and the sons did, and the decorations, and there's the first, second, and third place winners. But they had a great time. A lot of good things like this are going on every day in Parks and Rec, and they do it kind of on a shoestring. And I'm not necessarily advocating for more money. I'm just saying we can do a lot of creative things when we get people involved, and it's been worked out really well. I'm pleased to tell you, I know I sent you an email about this, but I'm pleased to let everyone know that the mutual aid agreement has been reinstated with Louisa, and that's a great thing for both counties. They had suspended the mutual aid agreement for EMS services last July because we had not been very well able to provide our part of the mutual aid and send rigs north when they needed them. Because we now have on board an emergency services coordinator that helps with those things, and now a contract crew, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Louisa voted unanimously to reinstate the mutual aid agreement immediately, and so that's good for both of us. And Ms. Wilkins, our emergency services coordinator, will track stats with our rescue squads just to make sure we know what's going north and what's coming south, and make sure that we can remain good partners and help each other out. We really need that in rural counties. Big youth lacrosse tournament coming this Sunday. There's going to be a lot of teams and a lot of people coming from out of the area. A lot of teams come from 90 or 100 miles away for this event. And so they'll be using the high school fields in Pleasant Grove. And so it's the kind of thing that can draw a lot of people to our county when we do these kinds of tournaments. And so the folks that have been working with the lacrosse leagues have done a really good job getting this set up. And it's a good event for venues here in Fluvanna. The library book sale, it's such a good deal, you'll scream. Starts the 7th, and they have lots of different events going on through the library book sale, and I can tell you, my wife and I spent way too much money last year. I'm glad that she and I are both going to be out of town this year. But I hope lots of people go and buy it. There's a lot of great bargains, a lot of really good quality books. This is not like the stuff that's 50 years old and stuck in a corner that the covers are torn off. There are a lot of good quality reading materials of all different stripes there, and they've got them really well organized. And so just some great opportunities to get some great literature for families, for kids, for adults. Really, really good program to get some money back in the library system, but also get some people some good bargains. The 4th Union Sanitary District Town Hall is set for December 12th. We're doing a town hall meeting at the 4th Union Community Center. We'll be sending out flyers and things to invite everyone in the 4th Union area, especially those that are part of the sanitary district and use the services there now of the water system. That will give us a chance to talk to residents and about the 4th Union Sanitary District and potential future and how we move forward and how we can make sure that state remains a viable system in the future. James River Water Authority had their second meeting yesterday. There will be a funding request coming probably at our next meeting, at your November 20th meeting. The James River Water Authority, in order to get the contractors to start moving the permit, do the permit move request, and to get the starting working on design to get the intake structure and the pipeline down done in the Columbia area, we'll need some seed money to start that process before we look for financing, long-term financing for the capital phase of the project. And so the JRWA board yesterday approved a resolution requesting $25,000 from each of the two counties to be able to act as seed money for that initial startup, to get the contractor to help get the permit moved from Primo to Columbia, to get the initial design started for the intake and pipeline, and for the legal services that are required by a regulated board like the JRWA. We'll also come back to the board with a little bit more detail on what those funds are for, but it's really the preliminary request. We've got to have some funds in our hand to be able to pay for certain things. Otherwise, we have to come back every single time something is expended, come back to the board for, you know, $50 for this, or $500 for this, or $2,000 for that. And so this would be the preliminary funding request. After that, it would be financing through JRWA, and then the financing plan would come back to both counties and say, well, here's how we do it through a service agreement for the counties to pay for their portion of it.
Does it look like it's going to stay within the $1.8 million for each?
I've heard higher estimates from other folks. I've heard anywhere between the $3 million and $6 million. So between $1.5 million per county to $3 million per county is numbers I've heard, but we don't have any official engineering estimates at all. Those are all based on previous engineering estimates, and it was based on a design at a different location on the river. So until we get the engineers to actually give us a design proposal on that, I just won't know.
So some people think maybe the total figure will be $6 million.
I've heard that figure from some of my colleagues on the JRWA board, which would be higher certainly than the 3.5 estimate, but we just don't know.
Okay.
So we'll have to have the engineering done up front. And everything that was done from an engineering perspective, the last time anything was done was 2007, I think, was the last presentation to the board, and then a follow-on in 2008. 2009, everything just kind of stopped. And so from that, we don't have anything newer than that for the James River Water Authority. And everything that was done from an engineering perspective back then was done on the BREMO permit and running up 15,
right,
and using either ECTI or Aqua Virginia or Dominion or a variety of different scenarios that don't fall in the same scenario as this one. So we need to have that study.
So you sort of drew the $1.8 million out of a hat, sort of, for this?
It was based on a formal engineering estimate and plussed up based on cost increases over the time that was done, but it was originally done in 2003, Mr. Stevens. The original estimate for the intake and for a portion of the pipeline was done in 2003. So we just don't have anything newer than that. But that was escalated based on inflation rates.
Okay.
So we need a formal current one. So we'll come back to the James River Water Authority. Will come formally to each of the two boards on the 16th of November for Louisa County, and on the 18th of November for 18th of November for Louisa, and the 20th of November for Fluvanna County, with that request and with some details with it to talk about what the funding is going to be for. The Pleasant Grove House, I appreciate Mrs. Booker and Mrs. Weaver coming in to meet with staff. I wish I had lots of good news about that project, but I'm sorry. Mrs. Booker and Mr. Weaver.
That's all right.
One of you guys has a birthday this week, and I can never.
That's all
right. Anyway, the two members who had the longest knowledge of the Pleasant Grove House plan and project came in and met with staff, and I really appreciate the time. I don't have lots of good news, and I didn't give either one of them lots of good news. We've looked at all kinds of sources for additional funding and grant sources and minimizing costs, but there are some costs we'll be presenting at your next meeting that are A, unavoidable, because you cannot use grant funds for it, but you cannot get the grant funds if you don't do that portion of the project. And like any 150-year-old building, 170-year-old building, I think it was built in 1854, something like that. It is a building that's fraught with problems. And just even after the meeting with Mr. Weaver and Mrs. Booker, the other day, I guess on Friday, we got the pictures in from the contractor. When they opened up the walls above the door, the existing door frames, and the timbers from one floor that hold one floor above the other, there's a lot of rot on the ends of those timbers. We're hoping it's not all over. We're hoping it's just limited to the door areas, but it will mean some cost changes on that too, and we'll have a full rundown of those pictures and things. But what's most worrisome is that you can't finish out a VDOT funded, a VDOT grant project without having significant historical aspects maintained. Interpretive displays, and essentially museum pieces throughout the building, and none of that's funded by the grants. And so when you do a grant to renovate, there's some sequencing problems and timing on that, but lots of people contribute to this to make it as robust a project as possible, but there are some things hanging out that are just going to make it problematic, and we're going to have to be requesting funds. Now, remember, the board did cut $100,000 from this project in 2010, I believe it was, or something, 2010, about thereabouts. Well, the $100,000 would get us back to healthy if there weren't problems in the building. So it'll be more than $100,000.
How much are we talking about?
Well, as of the other day, 170 was the number that we would be asking, but that's before we found these timbers on Friday or Thursday, whenever the contractor sent the photos, and Mr. Stevens went out and inspected the
And how much in grants have been delivered? I mean,
well, it's a complicated picture, so we're going to have to present the presentation to you. But there's $720,000 worth of grants, essentially, and that's from VDOT.
Correct.
And then there are another set of grants that the Historical Society helped with, and a variety of organizations that are part and partial. But it's a matter of sequencing and timing. The initial grants that were not VDOT grants were used to pay for the A&E, and the A&E can't be. You can't roll that in any extra on A&E. You can't roll on the top, and those grants can't be used. It's hard to do without the spreadsheets here. It's okay. A complicated picture, but we've looked at every different way we can think of to try to find funding for it, and there are not very many good answers.
Is there a concern about interpretive displays or things of that nature?
Big concern from the get-go. Since I got on board, I've heard problems about it. I know Mrs. Group talked about it at length because it's a difficult. That's an important part of the process. You have to have those, but it's not funded by the grant.
And has the Historic Society?
We've met with the Historical Society multiple times, and they're very supportive of the project, not necessarily supportive of finding additional grants or putting additional grants to it. We've looked at all the grant sources we could find that we think we could add to it, and we don't know of any, and even working with Mrs. Group, we've tried to identify those.
Either Ms. Mickelson or Mr. Moss, whichever one you believe are appropriate. Would you mind coming up, speaking to us, Mr. Moss?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Is there an issue with the interpretive displays? I mean, what exactly is the crisis du jour at this point in terms of resolving it?
Well, the Historical Society raised $130,000 in grants from various foundations in this area for the project. And I did that fundraising based on the fact that the county had committed $250,000.
Right.
Then the county took $100,000 away. So I had, I was asked by the county, by Pat Groot, if it would be all right if the county spent some of the money that we had raised for the initial expenses before construction, and they spent, I believe it was around $58,000 of the Historical Society's grant money. So the Historical Society's already been using its grant money for this project. The Interpretive Center is rather complex because if there's any T21 VDOT money left, some of that could be used for part of the Interpretive Center. But anything that you do in a museum using VDOT money has to be transportation related. In other words, and we've been meeting with the county staff to ensure that whatever we do at the, I keep calling it a visitor center, and that's everyone tells me that it's a welcome center, that the welcome, if it's a visitor center, you have to have all kinds of other, under state law.
Okay.
So it's a welcome center, but there are to be two museum display areas in there, one of which would be about the Rivanna River, the canals, and other transportation things, and the relationship of the Hayden family farm to transportation. So that would allow you to use part of the T21 money for that purpose. We have just met with the county, and the Historical Society have met recently with a very talented consultant who recently did the very fine Louisa County new Historical Society building in downtown Louisa, and they're beginning to think about how to interpret this and to figure out basic costs of how much would it cost to establish both the Welcome Center and the museum part. I, as president of the Historical Society, can't pledge any additional money from the Historical Society for this project. I could certainly help the county try to raise money from other foundations if, in fact, we have to do that. But I'm hoping that that won't be necessary. I think it's the fact that it's a combination of federal grants and many private grants coming together on a project that's historic in nature, and as Mr. Nichols was saying, you never know what you're going to find when you start out with this thing. One of the things they had to do was they discovered very quickly as they were excavating for the addition that the Pleasant Grove House, which was typically of that period in the 1850s, was not built with a foundation. And so they were going to attach a new building with a foundation to an old building that didn't have a foundation, and one was going to be settling and the other one wasn't. So they had to essentially go in and pour concrete buttresses to shore up the non-existing foundation of the old Pleasant Grove House. So all I can tell you is the Historical Society is very interested, in, of course, in completing this project. And we're also meeting with members of the Hayden family to restore and fence in the cemetery that's right in front of the house.
I think there's a gentleman that's president of the Historic Canals Association. I believe I spoke with him at Monticello, put Mrs. Groot in touch with him as well. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know who he is. I'm drawing a blank on his name at the moment. But there we go. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Judy knows all of his characters.
But yeah, so that's. I mean, I think it'd be a real shame to drop $720,000.
Yeah.
Money
There's almost no chance that you can go backwards now on this.
Yes.
I mean, and unfortunately, I hate to put the board in a position where you need more money for something unexpectedly, but think of a couple things. A, not a strong enough contingency built in maybe on a 170-year-old building. B, the board did pull $100,000 back for other funding of different things that were important and necessary at the time. And C, on top of it, when you find some catastrophic problems in an old building, you're a little bit too late down the road. And if we stop the project, that $720,000 goes away, and the contractor still has to be paid.
And I would have to repay foundations, and I would be coming to Fluvanna County to help out.
Yes, well, let's not put Mr. Moss in that sort of position.
Okay.
The train has left the station.
Let me
mitigate the problems.
Yeah. Let me just finish by saying I think that this project, when it's finished, is going to be a real gem, mm-hmm. and I think people will be astounded at what it adds to what is already a fantastic public space and park.
So long as it adds due consideration to the town of Columbia, I will be very pleased.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Moss.
So we'll get to do a full brief at the next meeting, and it'll include the pictures and diagrams and charts and the rundown of the money. We've already done that with Mrs. Booker and Mr. Weaver, but I wanted to at least give you a heads up that we've had that meeting, but this other project problem came up on Friday, so we'll add that to the list, and it was 170. And I don't know where we'll end up. The VACO conference is this weekend, so I'll be at the VACO conference Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Monday's a holiday, the Veterans Day holiday, but I'll be there and back to work on Tuesday afternoon.
And I'll be there too.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. This is a list of some of the things that are going that staff's been working on for supervisors. A few of those we'll get reports on. In the, I think a couple of them, the December 4th meeting, and follow up, and then some of you I've been sent individual emails to about VDOT things that have been happening in your areas, but those are what's ongoing. And I'd also like to just take a moment to recognize Ms. Allison Fincham. Allison's been our planning director for the last year and a half, and she's gotten a really good opportunity in the county of Louisa, and unfortunately, Louisa's. I mean, the good thing is Louisa's close, so we can still call her and ask questions. But our loss is Louisa's gain, but she's going to be the Director of Community Development in Louisa County, and really appreciate her service to Flavanna and the time she's been on board. I think you've all gotten notifications about a going away event on Friday, and so we'll say farewell to her. This is her last official board meeting, although I think she's got that's Planning Commission meeting is the day after she leaves, I think, so. But anyway, so thank you very much for your service to Flavanna. And any other questions I can answer for the board?
Just to echo very quickly, Ms. Fincham, you set a very high bar for professionalism here in Flavanna County. Your predecessor, your successor will merely succeed you and could not replace you. So, thank you very much for everything that you've done for Flavanna. It's noted and appreciated. And you will be missed. There's no question. So, any immediate questions for the county administrator? I have one. Town of Columbia, deputy, part-time. Anything? Nothing. Can we have something formal from the sheriff by the 20th of November for presentation, please?
I'll try.
Yes, if the board would so direct.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm not sure I can direct that one, but.
What are we doing on this?
I want a presentation as to what our options are.
I
think we've sort of asked the question, and it's been very busy for the sheriff the last couple of weeks, so I just want to make sure we get an answer to the question and give the board options as to what we can do. See if we can get a part-time deputy down towards the town of Columbia in the peak hours, so to speak. Any further questions to the county administrator? None. Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Moving on to our first round of public comment. Again, please remember to keep your comments directed to the board on topic and within 5 minutes. Is there anyone wishing to address the board at this time? Seeing none. Chairman Gooch, it's good to have you back, sir.
No, not the chairman anymore.
Mr. Gooch.
Yes, my name is John Gooch. I think this is the first time I've ever been on this side speaking to the board. So, first thing I'd like to do is thank Mr. Kenny and Mr. Chesser for their time that they've spent serving Flavanna County. I know what it's like to be over there, as well as the rest of the board members. I come to you this afternoon wearing a totally different hat than the last time you saw me. I'm still an engineer. I'm no longer doing that. I am the executive director for Community Energy Conservation Program. You have a brochure in front of you as to what we do. I'm trying to get our name out there in front of you. We'll be in the not-too-distant future, talking to DSS and your social services folks as well. We've been in business they've been in business since 1978. I started September the 3rd. I'm learning a lot and having a good time doing it. We're a nonprofit organization that provides weatherization for low-income families in the counties of Albemarle, Flavanna, Green, Louisa, Nelson, Augusta, Highland, and Rockingham, and the cities of Charlottesville, Harrisonburg, Stanton, and Waynesboro. Basically what we do, it's in there too, but we provide direct services to improve energy efficiency in low and moderate income households. They include, we do full house energy audits. We seal air leaks with insulation, caulking, and weather stripping. We repair leaky duct systems. We repair or replace inefficient or unsafe heating systems. We install carbon monoxide and smoke detectors. We install energy-efficient light bulbs, and we replace non-efficient refrigerators. We use the latest equipment and very highly skilled workers, and when we go in and weatherize a house, we generally save them 30% in their energy bills, which is incredible, especially for someone that is low income. Right now, we're presently in what's called crisis, which is run by Department of Social Services. If somebody comes to Department of Social Services with no heat, they will contact a vendor such as us, and within 48 hours, we'll do an inspection, and we will either fix it or we'll relocate them till something can be done. September 2012 in Flavanna, we've weatherized 8 homes. We are in the process of applying for the weatherization for the department through the Department of Housing and Community Development. We will be coming to the board for a letter of support so that we can continue this service. As I said, CECP has been doing it since 1978, and it's an incredible program. It's not as well known as it should be. That's one of my jobs, so that's why I'm here, to let you know. This isn't a real presentation. If you have any questions for me, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Any questions?
If not, I think I sent everybody an email, and our information is in there, and you can get in touch with me.
Do you have a certain amount that you can spend on a home? Is there a ceiling?
$6,500.
$6,500.
For weatherization. The crisis is $2,500.
Okay.
So, and it's amazing what we can do for $6,500.
Right. We this do is it available in, to in renters, owners?
Renters, yes, as long as the residents qualify.
Right.
It starts at 150% of the state median income, which is roughly $27,000.
Is this a PDF that you have on your site? I could hand this out to some folks?
Yeah. Okay. It should be there, and if not, I can make sure you get some more of them.
Okay, that's cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we have a couple of folks calling together that could use that.
The phone number's in there. There's a link to the website, so. Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gooch.
Thank you.
Good seeing you again. Anyone else wishing to address the board? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the first round of public comment. Note to items for public hearing. Moving on to action matters. Tab B, the adoption of the draft 2014 Thomas Jefferson Planning District legislative program. Mr. Blount.
Just the memo and the document itself, probably the document. So.
Not sure though, because it's in Word format. Oh,
what? I did that.
I'll scroll down when you need it.
Okay.
Since it's in Word.
I'll speak to just the first several of the priority items in the beginning.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the board, I appreciate the time on the agenda this afternoon. You do have before you, for your review and approval, the draft legislative program for 2014. It contains the same six priority items from this past year. There has been some repositioning and some refocusing to place some heavier emphasis on different items than what we had this past year. Again, the majority of those priority items have been in the program and have been among our priorities for a number of years. The program also later on contains a section of ongoing positions. That's where you typically find positions on issues that are outside of the priority areas, and also requests that have come from individual localities throughout the region. I did want to talk about some of the things that are in a few of the priorities, and the first being public education funding, which upon the request of several of the localities in the region, that has been made the top priority for this coming General Assembly session. And that's really being done at a time at which the state's funding of K-12 education has gone from 35% of the total general fund budget for the state back in fiscal year 2009 to less than 30% here in fiscal year 14. We've also seen the per pupil expenditures from the state drop during that time by about $400. At the same time, the student enrollment across the state has been increasing to the tune of about 30,000 additional students over that five-year period. I also wanted to mention VRS a little bit farther down in the third paragraph. That's always such a big ticket item. The VRS Board of Trustees has just approved or recommended for approval new teacher contribution rates that bump up from 11.66% of compensation to 14.5%. So that's about a 24% increase. I'm sure Ms. Keller's staff is calculating how much that's going to cost in additional dollars because the state will put up its portion But of course, that drives some additional local cost as well. When I was here before you in September, I mentioned another VRS-related issue that's also addressed in that paragraph, and that's a coming change in the Governmental Accounting Standards Board rules, which will require that unfunded liabilities for the teacher pension program be shown on the books of the entity that funds the teacher retirement, and that in this case being at the local level. Of course, the state puts in its contributions. Actually, it's the localities that, through some reimbursement to from the state, is actually paying all of those costs. We think the state puts in money, the state sets benefits. This position reflects the notion that that should be a shared responsibility as well, so that localities do not take that big a hit on their ledgers.
How much did it take out before to balance the budget? Was it like $800 million?
Yeah, it was. I want to say it was somewhere in the $600 to $700 million range, and they've actually are supposed to be paying that back over a 10-year period.
Supposed to be operative words.
That concerns me.
It does. Yeah, and what the state has set a goal of doing, and then again, we're just talking their share, is to bump up. You know, through the recent years, they have not been paying the rates or putting in the money that the VRS Board of Trustees has recommended. So they've gotten themselves in this big hole. So over the course of the next couple of biennia, they want to get back to actually get to the point of paying 100% of what they're supposed to have been paying all along. And I think you'll see an effort to get up to 80% in the next biennium.
But I'm wondering, at one time it was around $40 billion, and it had gone up with stock market and everything.
The value of the pension plan, yeah. It's up to.
Yes, and I wondered how much of that covered the lack of money that they actually had then in that fund, because it went up tremendously there over a couple of year period.
Yeah, the way the VRS actually the current value of the fund is over $50 billion now. But when they're actually recognizing those highs and lows, they do that over a 5-year smoothing period. So, we're still recognizing losses, that occurred, I guess, back in 2009 and 2010. And of course, the last several years we've seen increases in their portfolio.
Pretty large increase.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, in fact, I think this past year it was 11% or so, and I think they've had, ones that have been higher than that.
Yeah. The problem is they use their rainy day fund as an operating fund. They use the VRS as a rainy day fund. And so, Gilmore started it, and then Kane really went into it,
right.
And then, Donald got stuck with the bag.
Yes.
And he made it worse. He didn't even improve it. But that's all they're doing is they're allowing the economy to recuperate the loss, which might work for the meantime, but until you get another economic dip. And
exactly.
Then
yeah, and they're not, and they operate on a negative cash flow basis anyway. They're really depending on those gains in the portfolio because they take in about $1 billion less than they're paying out in a given year.
Right, and
that's the problem.
That's the problem.
That we face.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
but
the
it's
government.
But it's been underfunded for at least 20 years and maybe longer. So I am hopeful that there will be some interest and an effort to put additional money into public education in the next biennium. I think there's going to be some additional revenues that they're, beyond what their required commitments are, and beyond the 2-year re-benchmarking and the additional cost and money that will have to go toward that. That there will be some effort to put some additional money into education. Hopeful.
Do you think that's going to be this biennium, or they're going to punt 2 years and wait until Governor McAuliffe can actually get a chance to write his own budget?
Well, I'm looking at it from the standpoint of the legislative branch and their prerogatives and, hopefully them trying to make that as a priority.
Okay.
I'm being hopeful.
I'm usually
operate in the realm of the probable as opposed to the possible. So I'm trying to change my ways a little bit, especially when it comes to the General Assembly.
I'm not terribly optimistic, but I like your enthusiasm.
Did I say opportunities as opposed to optimism?
No,
I'm hoping for opportunities. If we move to the next priority, we'll continue our focus this year on mandates and funding obligations and cost shifting. As you know, we put a lot of emphasis into that last year. That's been a big part of Mr. Chairman's efforts here in the last several years by virtue of the commission, the task force that he has served on, but certainly continuing to emphasize this to the state that they not impose mandates on us, that they not shift cost of programs to the localities, and that they preserve our local revenue authorities. There was another task force that I mentioned last time that's been meeting to look at ways to enhance the local fiscal impact review process. I think some of the changes to that that we'll see will hopefully happen over the course of the next year. I don't think they're going to be in place with this coming General Assembly session. That will happen internally. We'll probably have a piece or two of legislation to put forward at this coming General Assembly session. But again, I think we're looking, you know, a year out before, you know, hopefully there's a little better process in place that can help to determine what the fiscal impact, both of legislation and hopefully in the future budget items, which has been the real rub for us in the past few years, so that we can get a better handle on what the impacts of those are, so that legislators have that information and can hopefully take that into consideration prior to making what have been some not good decisions in the interest of localities. Moving on down to transportation, and I'll be very brief. Here, we've really tried to focus in on restoring the allocations for secondary and urban construction that were taken away several years ago. We've also continued with a very strong statement opposing the shifting of responsibility for secondary roads from the state to localities. I thought that one was one that had kind of made its way to the back burner until I was at a meeting this summer, I think, that I shared with you before, where it was brought up by one of the legislative staff members of something that they saw as a future policy decision that the General Assembly was going to have to deal with.
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned it in the report, but it is something to bear in line. I guess back in 1933, when the Commonwealth of Virginia actually took over the transportation mm-hmm. system, they actually confiscated much of the county
right.
equipment.
They took the equipment.
Yeah. They took the equipment. So if they're going, if de-evolution is their game, then it'd be really nice if we could be reimbursed for that investment prorated from 1933 to today.
Or give the equipment back.
Yeah, or get the same equipment.
It's an opportunity.
It's another opportunity.
We'll get their old stuff,
I imagine. But seriously, though, it is, you know, I mean, that's something that the Commonwealth of Virginia confiscated from its localities, and if they intend to pursue devolution, then they need to sure. put back what they took away. And otherwise, that's just confiscation. Yes. That's not devolution.
Sounds like full of opportunities.
But maybe. In any event. Well, I think it's useful to include that because yes. I'm not so sure that many members of the General Assembly have that institutional memory.
Yeah, I can certainly, in the supporting rationale for that, yeah, I can certainly add something to that.
Very helpful individual DDoT.
Yeah, something along the lines of being provided you know, adequate resources or you know, equipment. You know,
They took it in 1933 yeah. ostensibly to maintain our roads, and yeah. we'd like it back.
17 shovels.
It's not worth much now.
Well, great.
We had two roads in there.
I'll add a statement to that.
So, what do we get, a dump truck or a shovel?
A 1930s dump truck.
Looking at the way they maintain the VRS,
if it's inflated. From 1933, it'll be a really expensive truck.
That's true.
That's maybe true. Two shovels.
I once litigated a case involving county roads maintained in the 30s, and the principal item of maintenance was a grader drawn by a team of mules.
Team of mules.
So I think the mules are probably pretty far gone by now.
Was that one of your first cases in the 30s?
Is it a jar of glue?
It wasn't current at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
I called it old codger evidence.
I would bet in some places in Fairfax County, for instance, would be very interested to get back some of their more modern equipment.
We would be hopeful. That's
yes,
for sure.
Very hopeful.
Mr. Chairman, the last thing that I will mention is if Mr. Nichols could scroll down in that position to write the position statements back up to.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, under TMDL.
Yeah.
Oops.
To the position statements there. At the end of number one there, you will see support for modified stormwater management plans for individual lots. This issue has come up among a number of localities, including one in this region that suggested it to me, and also in some other avenues, and I think it's going to be going through the VACO policy process next week as well. Right now, the code requires if you have an individual lot and you're going to disturb an acre or more of land, that you have to develop a stormwater management plan. You have to do runoff reduction spreadsheet, a whole list of requirements. And I think there's a feeling that those will be pretty burdensome requirements on an individual homeowner and potentially very costly. And so this position lends its support to what I think we'll see is some proposed code changes to actually set up what's called an agreement in lieu of a plan. And it's very similar, I think would be very similar to some provisions that are now in place for erosion and sediment control plans. So I just point that out because I think stormwater is something that's certainly on everyone's mind in counties as you move towards next summer's deadline to have local programs in place. And I anticipate that we'll probably see some other legislative proposals that, you know, hopefully will address some of these little things that are popping up as we've gotten into what those plans
are. Are there a series of, say, model ordinances or anything like that that TJPDC is batting around? I know that Spotsylvania is getting ready to emerge with something, but...
Yeah, we have not done anything. It was my belief.
The state has some.
Yeah, the state's got some, and I know you all working with soil and water conservation, as I believe most of the other folks in the region are.
Okay, because I know. But I know there's some out there. This is a big rock, so it's this is not something that's going to be comfortable.
Yeah.
But.
So that's all I really wanted to bring up on the priorities. Again, in the second part of the program, there are those ongoing positions, and there's a few modifications in there, again, based on requests that I got from different localities in the area or to address some things that we anticipate coming up or that kind of fall outside of those priority areas. But before I entertain your questions or suggestions or comments, I would remind you, I believe I sent out a save the date several weeks ago for the annual legislative forum, which this year is going to be held on Tuesday, December the 3rd at the TJPDC's Water Street Center. We've got a couple of presenters coming in from the Richmond area to talk to us about implications to localities of the Affordable Care Act. So again, you know, several years ago we shifted the focus of the legislative forum to not be so much on, you know, what is a very similar program from year to year and that you all are familiar with and that the legislators are pretty familiar with, to be really focused on a topic of interest that can be educational both for legislators as well as our elected and appointed officials throughout the region. And we have several of the legislators in the region that are part of that commission at the state level that's looking at this.
What time is it on?
We're going to start at 6 o'clock with a little meet and greet, and then get into the program about 6:30 or so.
Okay.
But we'll be sending out invitations to that here in the next week or so.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to take questions, and again, we'll be asking for your approval of the program today.
Yeah. Any questions on the board?
No.
No. Do we have a motion to approve?
Mr. Chair, I move that the Board of Supervisors adopt the 2014 draft Thomas Jefferson Planning District Legislative Program, understanding that additional suggestions and revisions to the draft may be incorporated into the final version.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion is made by Mr. Chesser, seconded by Mr. Ullenbrock. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Moving on to tab C, Capital Reserve Maintenance Fund request for bus cameras. Mr. Winkler is not here, so he's... Certainly.
And give you a quick bit of information. Right now we have approximately 70 buses. Of those 70, 20 of them have working cameras. Of the 20 that are working, 10 are digital and 10 are the old VHS. And it's really gotten to the point that you can't even find very many blank VHS tapes to make use of. And we want to start replacing these.
Questions on the board?
All right.
If not, we have a motion.
No, before we have a motion,
questions on the board? Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
I have a few concerns. It's not that I'm not for it. It's my concerns are number one, it was cameras. I sort of have a problem with privacy and cameras and the use of the films. If it's almost a weekly basis now, you see on national TV that occurrences happen on buses that are serious. They end up in the hands of the media, and and you've got innocent people that are end up on media broadcasts over an incident on a bus. I did speak with the sheriff on this and got his input, but I haven't gotten any input from parents, bus drivers, past incidents that the cameras have been needed. I just have concerns on the privacy thing. I think
we've gotten to this point in the country where everywhere you go, you're on film. I mean, almost from the second you leave your house. If you're in Charlottesville, that's absolutely true. It's a concern. And it's not that I don't want to approve it. It's that I don't want to automatically just say, yeah, go ahead and do this. And I don't want to say don't do it and have a problem later that something happened to a bus driver that wasn't seen or talked about or denied. So those are the troubles I have with it. I don't know if anyone else on the board has any
issues. We've had cameras on buses for how long?
Many years. New buses typically come equipped with digital cameras.
We have cameras in the schools, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Hallways. Oh, yeah. Everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's
every school.
For basically for protection.
For security.
Security. And usually if a camera picks up an incident, when I've seen it on TV, they blur out other kids' faces and just concentrate on the people really doing whatever they're doing. You probably can state times when cameras have been very vital in investigations so that the wrong kid is not accused. I never forget one time I had a camera of a little boy, and he was so smart. He knew when the driver wasn't looking in the rearview mirror, and he'd run up and grab the little girl's hair. You know, so I said, told the mom, she said, no way my baby would do that. Wait till I threw that camera on, she said, boy. But, that's kind of hilarious.
But it did change the focus of the conversation.
You know, he got his punishment due. He you can't lie.
Bob's probably wrong with pulling out
of his hair. Oh, but anyway, get back to the. Well, that was serious.
Yeah.
That they are needed. I mean, it's a thing of today.
It is.
Unfortunately.
Right.
And I understand what you're saying.
The key is it's unfortunate that we've gotten to that. No, that we've gotten to that point.
That's true.
You know, we are continually giving away our freedoms and our privacy one vote at a time. And I think that's where we're at here. I haven't heard from parents. I haven't heard from bus drivers. I've just heard a request for cameras, for $30,000, give me cameras and we're gonna put them in the buses. And that's the money means nothing here. It's the concept. And we've passed approved other things that I've come to question later that involved cameras
Well, frankly, I just think it's absolutely necessary for these buses to have safety and security for the kids and for the bus driver. I think it's the time, it's the age, we have to deal with that. Oh, by the way, Bob, there's a camera right up there watching you right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right up there.
Yeah.
So I would offer the motion that we approve this.
And the driver most of the time is driving with 60 to 70 kids at their back.
Especially when they have mixed groups. You have some older kids and some younger kids. That's best to have those cameras to protect them, and also the driver. And I think the parents really would appreciate that.
Yeah, I think what Bob's saying is, certainly there's a lot of validity to that, but I think we're in an age, Bob, like I told you, I had mixed feelings about that.
Right.
I don't know that we have any real option here on that.
I didn't bring it up to turn it down. I brought it up to have a discussion and not just pass it and get on to the next thing. I think it deserves.
And how far discussion. Do we continue to go? I mean, other than just this, it's outer space and everything else that their surveillance is and all. So
y'all still are putting individuals on the bus.
I just thank God we didn't have cameras when I was a kid.
Doing what?
You need to repeat that. I don't think they heard what you said.
U.S. Marshals for buses.
But I would like to add that we have very, very strict protocol as to how we make use of anything in that video, and Ms. Booker alluded to that. Parents cannot could come in and just view an entire scene that doesn't involve their child. And there, we've had situations where the camera has helped us resolve things even within a neighborhood that children brought to school on a Monday after some neighborhood discourse. And there are lots of situations where it is helpful. I think it's we're better served having them than not.
Yeah, I think we're forced into it with lawsuits and everything else.
Oh, sure.
Whether we want them or not.
So where's this money going to come from?
Capital Reserve Maintenance Fund. And that's the question I have. There is money sitting aside there, but the question from the county administrator perspective is, I want to make sure I don't get too far afield on making recommended approvals on things that are truly ongoing maintenance versus the Capital Reserve Maintenance Fund's original intent. And this is obvious to me an important issue, and the school superintendent knows more about it than I do. But I don't want to necessarily have staff bring forward an issue that is something that's either normally a budgetary item or just ongoing maintenance as part of our regular program. The Capital Reserve Maintenance Fund request, as I heard from you, was intended for kind of those unexpected things, like when your AC unit goes out in your building and it wasn't budgeted for that year and those kind of things. Things that were kind of unexpected that you needed to have a pot of money set aside for so you didn't get hammered with those unexpected occurrences. And so I think from the school system and the county government side, we just need to be careful as we bring the request forward because that's what the policy was you set.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I mean, I think caution in that regard. I'll be honest with you, this feels very much borderline. I'm thinking, you know, AC units. You know, I'm thinking, you know, holes in the roof. I'm thinking, you know, the pipes bursting or some nonsense like that. Things that are designed to go ahead and make sure that we do the sort of investment and capital costs that don't create recurring costs in the future. The civil libertarian in me is absolutely hostile to the idea of cameras being everywhere and all that nonsense. It's fine. But I also understand that this is not something that was designed for the Board of Supervisors to do that, which probably isn't constitutional. But the long and short of it is that it was really designed to help us work together on the big ticket items and things of that nature. And so, I think this gets really close to that line just of the intent, but I don't believe that if this is a request of the administration and the school board, then, you know, clearly there's a need for it, and yes, there's an insurance issue with it as well.
There's insurance savings on this, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so yes. So I think it's something you have to do at the end of the day, and unfortunately this is the world we're living in, but until somebody comes up with a better way of maintaining security, I'm all ears. But
so that $30,000 will put new cameras.
How much saving is it?
You know, I don't know that. I just know
because
we've
had the cameras, we don't know.
So. Yeah. I mean, I don't know per bus or how that's calculated, but there's. I mean, even when you have buildings with security cameras, homes that have ADT have a better insurance rate. You know,
right,
typically.
Right.
So
we always know the difference.
Pardon?
I say, but we always know the difference then.
Oh, yes, yes. We would know the difference. I can find that for you if you'd like to know the difference.
I was just curious. We were discussing that. I was just curious what the difference was.
So the issue is whether or not we want to approve this, but the other thing is that when we look at this type of thing, it should be included in the normal budget rather than in the maintenance.
I would ask for that to be the case in the future.
So we need to be more careful in how we look at those things, make sure we plan.
But also understanding that we are, to some degree, catching up, because these are things that, not because of the prior administration, but in years past, these are simply things that just went by the wayside. And so we are trying to address those collaboratively, and that's why we have these conversations. They're appropriate to have.
Do you have a plan for replacing them as they get older?
Yes, what we want to do actually is we've already started planning with Sheriff Washington to look at security systems. We've had done a vulnerability study through the Sheriff's Department. We've done our safety review that what's required through the Department of Ed. But linked to that, there will be grant money coming back, probably hit us in the spring again to apply, have matching funds. Sheriff Washington also believes that there may be access to funds even through the course of this year. So we see this as a borderline, we do, but we also see it as with the heightened awareness about safety and security. We see it as a huge need.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we continue to cycle through our school bus fleet, this is not a problem.
This is going to be a non-issue. That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. And we do appreciate that.
If we keep continuing with the plan, this problem goes away.
Right.
This is symptomatic. It's not.
And it is nice to see those new buses out there.
It is.
I mean, it really
is. Buses and new deputy
cars. And less blue smoke. That's right.
So, Mr. Chair, I move that the Board of Supervisors approve a capital reserve maintenance fund request to purchase and install 20 bus monitoring cameras with GPS and video enhanced software on the Luvana County Public Schools buses at a price of $25,500.
Second.
Motion is made by Mr. Chester, seconded by Mr. Uhlenbrock. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Thank you, Mrs. Cullen.
Thank you.
Moving on to tab D, appointment to the Agriculture Forestry Advisory Committee. Ms.
Nichols. There's one applicant for that vacant position. That's Mr. Zimmer, currently serves on the Planning Commission. And now that just popped in my head, is there any prohibition on Planning Commission member doing that? Just or not? Maybe it's just BZA member.
BZA.
Definitely one of the BZA. Let me check the.
Yeah, obviously Mr. Zimmer works for Virginia Department of Forestry, so he'd be an excellent choice for this.
Yeah, he'd be great. I just know there's a prohibition for BZA members can only serve on the Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if there's a prohibition on Planning Commission the other way.
I don't believe there would be a conflict of interest in this. I mean, obviously with BZA and Planning Commission there would be, but.
I don't think so. Let me, if you all go ahead and discuss this, and if you would, if you get to the point where I'm finished and you get to the point of the appointment, do it subject to.
I think they're at that point.
Yeah, I think we're at that point. There's not a whole lot else to discuss.
Why don't you then appoint him, if you're going to appoint him subject to my checking the statute to make sure it's lawful.
So moved. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Chester, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Thank you, Mr. Payne. FY14 pay plan, Ms. Parrish.
Good afternoon. Time of the year to adjust our pay plan so we can move forward on looking at the budget for next year. And at the review of the pay bands, I took a look at them and made adjustments since they have not been adjusted on the minimum size since 2008. And we did make adjustments last year to the maximum because we had made the adjustments for the VRS 5.28%, so I did not make any adjustments there. So I took a look at the pay bands, and depending on each band, the range of adjustment was anywhere between 5-10% that I increased them. I rebalanced the mid-range once I made the adjustments. And again, no maximum pay rate adjustment. Once I did that, then I took a look at all of the schematic with all the positions, and I compared where they were sitting on the pay bands currently to what the current weighted averages are for those positions. And I have made some recommendations. 15 upgrades of new pay bands for those positions. Two of the positions I did recommend downgrade. It does not affect anybody's salary. Everybody's salary is sitting within that except for two positions. Two title changes have been recommended, and they are both for the Parks and Rec positions. This is the salary proposal, the salary schedule proposal with the ranges. How do I pick up the schematic? Okay, the schematic, as you can see, and it's just quick, it would show the position and where it sits on which band. That's all.
You're using the term bands, maybe comparable to steps that
no,
the school
sir.
System uses?
The band is from a minimum to a maximum range.
Okay.
And it's band one would be
as you can see, the minimum would be $8.29 an hour. The maximum would be $12.38 an hour. That would be the maximum any position that was approved.
Right.
There are no steps. I think it was 2007? Was it 2007, 2006? The board removed bands, and that's part of the reason why I'm trying. I mean, steps. That's part of the reason why I'm trying to readjust the bands. There were steps within those bands, so we have extremely, in many cases, the bands are really too large, too extreme, and I'm trying to, within what we have sitting in the positions that are approved for them, also adjust them so that, because we do not have the steps within the pay plan anymore.
So in part of our pay plan is that for the last several years, it's just been a static pay plan that has 30 different bands, 30 different levels of pay for different types of levels of jobs. If you look on this schematic, that's an HR word that talks about the types of positions. So let's say a seasonal camp counselor, that's moving from pay band 4 to 5, but it's a pay band 5. A bailiff is a pay band 9, part-time bailiff. A finance director is a pay band 23. It's just different levels for different types of positions based on the requirements of that position. So the movements are to reflect the skill set required of that job. Although there's no pay changes, it's putting them in the correct band. The bands themselves don't have any flexibility other than from minimum to maximum. And there's no automatic pay raises because the steps went away a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So there's no, like after 2 years in a certain pay grade, you get an automatic 2% increase or 1.5% increase to step 2 or step 3 right. or step 4. We don't have that built in. All you get now is you get proposals from either individual directors or constitutional officers for a pay increase for an individual for a position, or you get a once-a-year proposal in the county administrator's budget plan that has a pay plan in it that Ms. Parrish puts together. But it's really a rudimentary structure of 30 different levels of pay with different minimums and maximums in those levels without any adjustments.
When you do the budget, then, for example, I guess if you get a 1% raise, it moves within that band.
Person in the position
right.
would move within that band. They would not go beyond the maximum because
right.
what you have to look at is the position, when I recommend the position to be classified at pay band 7, then what I've done is gone out and I've looked at what the market would pay, and that the reason I recommend 7 is because based off of what that position's required to do, that would be an average of what to pay that employee from an entry level to an experience level.
So when somebody's hired, you would determine what pay band they were in, and then
no, sir. That's where the position. When you determine
the position right.
yes.
okay.
it just, already is.
You
established.
Can determine in that range what
within that range. Right. Mr. Nichols has up to 15% to approve from entry
right.
level up to 15%. Anything over 15% would have
right.
to be brought to you all and have that approved,
sure.
and it would also have to meet the budget. You'd have to be able to show that you have it in the budget to pay.
Sure. Mr. Earl Ellenbrock brought up an excellent point. He was very concerned as to whether or not these were all living wage jobs. Are we going to be able to index these rates to the CPI?
Slowly I'm getting all of us up there, yes.
Okay.
The lowest paid you have right now are $9 an hour because you fixed in
for
last year's budget for full-time, right. There were some that were in the low eights.
What's the living
wage
adjusted
in the last pay plan?
1075.
Full-time positions start, the lowest full-time position starts on pay band 3. Pay band 1 and 2 are temporary and
seasonal
employees.
And we basically don't start at the minimum.
Well, some people do.
Depends
some
on the budget.
The last year, they come in and they start at the minimum for that pay band. It really depends on their experience set and their education. So you take the requirements for the job,
you look at those individuals, and then Ms. Parrish can make a recommendation on their experience and their years of education. Give them the ability for us to offer more than the minimum to get that specific skill set in. But many people do start at the minimum for that pay band.
So I can stay at band 5 for years. All the time I get off of 5
if
is
we
when
give
I
them
go
a raise.
Past 33, 110.
No, the only time you would get off of 5 is if your position changed.
Right. Or if we
been there for 34 years and you're at the top of the maximum, that's the max that you can receive. Okay. Most organizations, if the employee, generally an employee is not going to sit at the max. Mm-hmm. But if they're at the max, that's what's determined the max to pay for that job.
It's not worth any more than
it's
that.
It's not worth any more.
Right.
Right. You could
upgrade my skills.
But if we do a 2 or 4% raise, that raises that max.
Well,
two different kinds of raises. Right. There's yeah. kind of raises for a skill set thing or for a position change, or we've got more requirements added in the job, and then the basic cost of living increases. But the cost of living increases when they bump up against the maximums. That's where.
And then generally what they do is, in our policy, when I'm looking at it, it's not there now, but generally if somebody's at the max and let's say they've been sitting there and they're about to retire or something, but we want to recognize and everybody else is getting an increase, then they would get a one-time bump of X amount of dollars for how many years over. You know, it depends on what the policy states, but a lot of places do give a lump sum at once a year if somebody's mm-hmm. at the max. But generally, a good supervisor, if you've got somebody that's been sitting there and they haven't, and if their skills are increasing and they're above what the skill level is at position, if there's a need for that, what they would need to do is bring it back and demonstrate, look, we've got this person who's skilled at this, this is our need for this, and I want to pay them equivalent to what they're actually doing. I would reevaluate the position based off of what they are utilizing and the needs, and then I might bring it forth and say, look, this position was this, these are the needs now of the county, this position is doing that, I would recommend it to be a job change and a band change, which would
You mentioned
allow
two individuals that would be receiving less pay over the schematic.
More. They're higher than the pay band.
No. There's two individuals that are sitting currently, when I made the adjustment, slightly below the minimum.
I thought we had two above.
We have one above.
Okay.
That one's been above for years and years.
And
it's one of our constitutional officers,
and
it's been known that position's been above what the maximum is for that one. Now, when I made these adjustments, there's two positions that currently sit below the minimum. Those are what I'm recommending that we do look at and make an adjustment at budget
up.
Time.
Okay.
Bring them up.
Yeah, even
right.
though I'm recommending to raise the right now because
right.
the position. Currently, they're sitting within the pay band where their position
mm-hmm.
is approved currently. I'm recommending, because of what their functions of the job and comparative to what others in the market do and other positions that are sitting with similar skill levels and functions, to move them up some bands.
But they're not below the current pay level.
They're not
below
the current.
This one, the proposed
they'll be below
one.
This
one.
Okay.
There's
the
no
minimum.
One who is going to be paid less under the schematic if we implement it.
The only person who will, there's only two positions if we approve the changes that will be currently sitting below the minimum.
No, but Mr. Kenny's asking, is anybody going to lose pay?
No. Nobody will
what
lose.
You've got is, okay. I'll give you an example. Let's say
no
it's,
pay change.
It's $10
okay.
an hour for
good.
Someone today.
Okay.
But
okay.
we're asking to adjust the pay schedules such that the bottom pay scale
right.
goes up because of the raises last year, so we adjust that. So now the minimum for that job is $10.50 an hour, let's say.
Right.
Well, that person may be at $10.12 an hour. So two people are going to be below the new
yeah.
lower level, and we'll address those during budget season to try to adjust those two positions if it's appropriate.
And who was that one person that you said was?
I don't want to say out.
No, I don't know in who. I mean, you did say one.
Oh, the one?
Person.
Oh, the
yeah.
that's a constitutional officer that is it's probably misclassified for years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a clerk of the circuit court because it's
an attorney position.
Right.
And I don't think it's ever been classified where it really should have been. That was the pay that's been there for
I didn't make
the clerk
that
for
adjustment.
Years.
Okay.
We haven't adjusted that pay band up to fit him in.
Yeah.
It's just that's what his pay has always been.
Right.
I mean,
okay.
Constitutional officers get a little bit more latitude, though, in establishing who gets paid what, do they not?
No, they
not that
no.
I know.
No.
No.
They're with they're still supposed to follow.
Not when they opt in.
Okay. They're supposed to follow the policy, the pay plan policy.
Yeah. Now, we based on the most constitutional officers, we have a state plan we have to follow. And we've got to pay at least that as a minimum.
Oh, yeah.
But we pay above those minimums.
Okay. So. Okay. Okay. That
like for social services in that case, too, in most cases.
Okay.
Okay. These are the adjustments. I just gave a summary of all the, from that schematic. As you can see, facility assistants, they are our temporary people that work in the Parks and Recs facilities. And that one I am recommending going from a 5 to a 4. However, the convenience center worker from a 4 to a 5. They're currently called programs assistants, parks and recreation. I am recommending both moving them from a 6 to an 8 and a title change because it's not accurate in consistency on how we use the terms assistant and specialist within our organization. So I worked with Mr. Smith and we came up with the title Recreation Program Specialist. I won't go through all of them. The other one was just a title change. Again, that is Administrative Program Specialist rather than an Administrative Assistant.
Part of Parks and Rec as well.
That's again Parks and Rec.
So we've got the same naming conventions.
And there is no band adjustment for that one, but just the title. All the rest are band adjustments.
Let me go back one slide and just show you one thing. On here,
oops,
sorry.
You did it and I did it.
No problem. On this one, as an example, when someone's going from 4 to 5, there's no pay adjustment now because they're still, they're, let's say they're at $10, $15, or $11 an hour. They still fall within the new band. They're not going below. So no one's losing any pay off that.
Right.
It's just we're reclassifying into the correct band where they should be. So as you do new hires or that person gets promoted or gets pay raises, it'll be within their bands. But again, no dollar impact at this time.
The do you have any questions on any of them that I'm making recommendations for or why I made the recommendations?
What exactly is the, I mean, apart from categorization, what exactly is the impact of changing their titles?
It stays consistent. Part of it is hiring. When you're trying to hire a specialist, is more descriptive, and it's also more consistent with the type of skill sets that we are looking at than if we look out there and look for an assistant. That's a little bit different. It's more of an entry-level skill set, whereas the people who are performing the jobs that they're doing now actually do, and it's more.
The title's more descriptive, but it's
more
also more in vogue in the park
what
and recreation
they do
world.
In the program. They also, anytime you're looking for somebody and you're putting it on your resume, it's more commonly known as a program specialist.
Do you have job descriptions?
Yes, ma'am.
Clear job descriptions for
absolutely.
Those two?
Yes. We all do. I am working with each department on taking a look at them and updating. And this was the first group that I went with is with Parks and Recs. Part of it is because he now has an employee that's about to retire, so he has an open position. So we took a look at his whole program, and we reviewed the job descriptions, what they actually are doing to make sure that they're still consistent. I've been doing this. I did it with the planning director when she had an opening earlier this year, or two openings in planning. So we took a look at those and reviewed those job descriptions.
Is that person who's retiring from Parks and Recreation, is that person sitting at that pay, a band now, or will the new person come in and be in a higher band because you've
They will all be, all of them. She will move into that higher band. She's being paid very close to the mid-range right now of the higher band. Mm-hmm. None of them are, it's going to affect their pay. What it will be is allow us to hire somebody at a slightly higher entry level.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Somebody. You know, like you leave a job.
But it will not be at the rate that that person is.
$50,000 and a new person come in and make $60,000.
No.
In almost all cases on lower level positions, people come in, if, depending on what the skill set is, they'll come in at a lower salary than the person's leaving. On executive positions, they may come in at the same salary because of the skill set and the years of experience. But it's not intended that every time you hire them at a higher cost than the previous one. Right. You'd never be able to run your organization.
Didn't happen in the past when you came on board either.
Well, you'd run yourself out of the market if you did that.
Sure. We
actually saved money on the new group of hires last time.
Actually, the recreation program specialists, all of them currently are sitting very close to, if slightly below the mid-range. Any new employee, unless they have equivalent experience and background in parks and rec and education, will not come in as what the retiring person will be paid. Right. However, if that would occur, we would have to come to you all because it would be above the 15%. Right. They're all sitting significantly above the 15% of the entry level.
The 15% latitude that the county administrator has is really based on the person's experience, education, and special skills they bring to the job that's above the baseline. We wouldn't necessarily offer that unless there was something to require that. If it's a significant one, it was more than 15% needed for the recruitment, I would come to you first, but we haven't done that since I've been here.
Good work.
And then here's just this is the summary. No salary changes at this time. As I said, two employee salaries will be, all but two will be within the proposed pay bands that I'm proposing. And then we're looking potential salary adjustments during budget season for the two. It also creates proper alignment for positions with similar market averages, and it creates more competitive salary ranges for our recruitment and retention. Okay. Any questions?
Any further questions? Hearing none, do we have a motion?
I move to adopt and approve the Savannah County FY14 pay plan, including the FY14 pay band salary schedule and the FY14 schematic list of classes.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mrs. Booker, seconded by Mr. Fair Living Wage Ullenbrock. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Moving on to presentations, program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. Pace, it's Dr. Friedman.
Mr. Chairman, before you get into that, checked the statutory requirements for Planning Commission and for the county code requirements for the Ag Forestal District Committee members, and I don't see any prohibition on the
members. Okay.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Payne. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Betty Sharp, and I'm the outreach manager for Blue Ridge PACE. Dr. Reeder couldn't be here, so I am taking her place.
Is that better?
Excellent. Very good.
So I'm not Dr. Reeder. I'm Betty Sharp.
Betty Sharp.
Can't claim that title. And first, I want to say that what I'm sharing today is for informational purposes only. I am not here to solicit PACE participants. Blue Ridge PACE is not allowed to market PACE services until we receive our final approval from CMS. And so hopefully in December is when you'll really start hearing about us all over the place. And hopefully in January we'll open our doors for our participants. So what is PACE? PACE stands for the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. And it's a nationally recognized alternative to nursing home care. You know, we all want the best care for our aging loved ones, but getting that care can be very frustrating. If you have an aging loved one, you know what it's like to drive them from appointment to appointment, to manage their medications, and then to deal with doctors who don't always communicate with each other. And then we struggle with leaving our loved one at home alone and without the supervision and the interaction that they want and that they need. So it doesn't have to be this way. Thousands of families across America have found a different and a better kind of care for their aging loved ones, and that's PACE. These PACE families have experienced a program that provides and coordinates all types of care that a loved one needs so that they don't have to go and live in a nursing home. PACE is a program that provides services to individuals that are over the age of 55 and who are eligible to receive nursing level of care, so they have to have that UAI. And they need to be able to live safely in the community with the support of PACE at the time that they're enrolled. We cover the Region 10 area, which is Charlottesville, Albemarle, Fluvanna, Nelson, Green, and Louisa. So, PACE is not a new program. You may not have heard about it, but it started in 1971 in the Onlock community in San Francisco. Onlock was a Chinese-American neighborhood, and the culture of their group was that they respected their seniors and they wanted them to be able to live at home. And they came together and they formed this healthcare model, which would continue, which would combine the services of an adult daycare with healthcare services and other services like transportation and home care as well, so that their elderly could remain in their homes. And the English translation of on lock means happy, peaceful abode. And that's how I like to think about PACE. And we're really fortunate in Charlottesville to have our PACE in partnership with JABA and with UVA. And our third partner is Riverside Health System, and they're located in the Tidewater area. And they operate 5 PACEs currently. And so they have the operational know-how. Blue Ridge PACE is going to be unique because we are partnering here in the community with UVA and with JABA. It's a federal and a state program, and there are PACE programs currently in 29 states, and throughout the United States there are over 90 programs that are up and going. And Virginia is the fastest growing state with 12 programs. And I like to think of PACE as a program of C's. We have community-based, we have a center, we provide coordinated, comprehensive care, and a capitated health care program. So our center, we are located on Carlton Avenue in Charlottesville. It's an absolutely gorgeous, brand new center, and we have 20,000 square feet of area where we're going to provide our services. We have a full clinic with a full-time geriatrician, nursing staff. We have lab services there right in the clinic. And we have the ability to bring in other services like dentistry, podiatry, audiology, and we also have a pharmacy there. So all the participants will receive all medications, prescription and non-prescription medications through our program. In our adult daycare center, we have a full-time recreational therapist, and she will provide a range of activities. And these activities are going to be individualized to the participants, and this will include field trips as well, and we will have activities that are geared toward our individuals that have dementia as well. We will serve those folks. There are actually 3 huge day rooms there. It's beautiful. Our dietary services include a full kitchen, and so we can provide hot meals and snacks right there. We have a dietitian right on staff. Home meals will be provided. If someone needs a home meal, that can be packaged and sent home with them as well. Our therapy gym for the rehab services is staffed with a full-time occupational therapist, a physical therapist, and they will work with the participants in the center as well as in the home. And we're also going to have a speech-language pathologist, too. other services. We have a social worker to provide all the social services. We have a full-time chaplain, and we have transportation services. We're actually partnered with Jaunt on that, and I know Jaunt serves your area as well. And the center will be operating Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Generally, most people come about 3 days a week, but it's completely up to them. If they choose to come every day, that's fine, or 1 day a week, or 1 day a month. And they'll have 24-hour access to care, so they don't go home at the end of the day and not have access to that. There's always somebody on call. And the wonderful thing about Blue Ridge PACE is that it's community-based and that we're able to collaborate with organizations like UVA and JABA and Jaunt. Another community-based part of our model is that we provide home care, remembering that these are folks that are nursing home eligible and they're often unable to care for themselves, doing some of their daily living needs. So home care aides will, if they need to go in the morning and help them get up and get dressed and have breakfast and get on the bus and come to PACE, then they can be there at the end of the day. They need that to greet them as well and help them in the evening. We'll also provide services on the weekend if that's deemed necessary. Comprehensive care. Our model covers all aspects of care, from medical to rehabilitation to social functioning, and it's all under one roof. So being this comprehensive integrated program is one of the greatest benefits to the participants. This means that when our interdisciplinary team sits down to meet on a daily basis to discuss the participants, everybody has a say at the table. It's not a physician-run program. It's a team-run program. So everybody comes to the table, and they contribute to that plan of care for each individual. And by everybody, I mean everybody. The CNAs who work in the day room, the nurses, the home care aides, the therapists, the doctor, the site director, Dr. Reeder, the social worker, the chaplain, and even the drivers, because oftentimes the drivers are the first person to see that individual at the beginning of the day and the last person to see him at the end of the day. Another C, coordinated care. It's all right there at the center through our physician. You know, if somebody comes in the morning and they don't feel well, they don't have to go back out and schedule an appointment to see their doctor. They come right to the clinic, and the doctor's there waiting for them and can, you know, get their issues resolved right away. Now, if somebody does need to go into the hospital, you know, or out to see their specialist, then our nurses are there to coordinate that care and help navigate them through the system, because that can be really tough. We also provide caregiver support. This will include respite care, caregiver training, caregiver support groups. I'm trying to hurry up so I don't stay up here more than 10 minutes.
You're fine. Keep going. You're good.
And finally, the last C, we're capitated. And you're probably wondering who pays for all of this. You know, it just sounds too good to be true. But it's actually paid for through Medicare and Medicaid. And PACE assumes the financial responsibility of the health care needs of the individuals who come to PACE. And we receive a capitated amount, a set pot of money, every month from Medicaid and Medicare. And out of that, that's how we provide all their health care services. And it's all determined by the team and the team partnering with the participant and their caregiver as well. So we're mandated to provide everything that Medicaid and Medicare provide, but we can actually pay for the extras that they're unable to cover. For example, transportation, that's all included. They'll have transportation to and from the center, to and from appointments they may have in the community if they need to go out and see their specialist. If they need a ramp, let's say they have a couple of steps to their front door and it's not safe to get them in and out of the house, you know, PACE will provide for that ramp to be installed there. And another example is Medicaid typically doesn't pay for anything beyond the bathroom door. So, you know, that's where most elderly have their falls. And, you know, we will put in the grab bars. We will put in the necessary supports that they need to keep it safe and hopefully prevent them from falling and going into the hospital and incurring all of that. So we like to look at ourselves as, you know, not a reactive healthcare model, but a proactive and a preventative model. And I should also mention that, you know, there's also a private pay option. It's not just for Medicaid, Medicare. there's also private pay option. So like I said, we expect to begin enrolling in December. We're just waiting. With the government shutdown, some things are a little slower, but we're hoping to get the green light and start marketing in December, enrolling, and then in January have participants start coming to our program. We have our ribbon cutting on November the 25th. That's the Monday before Thanksgiving at 10 a.m. And I'd like to invite you all, if you'd like to come, we're going to have speakers, refreshments, we'll be doing tours. If you can't come but you'd like to come and see our center, feel free to contact us. I'm happy to, or any of us there would be happy to give you a tour, especially between now and January, you know, before we have a busy, bustling center, you can come in and get the whole tour. And you know, feel free to share our information if you know of an organization that may want information, churches, you know, happy to come and speak to them and share. So thank you for giving me my 10 minutes plus.
Very good. Thank you very much. Moving on to the school's update and preliminary budget planning. Kelly.
Good afternoon. I was going to say good evening. Usually I'm here in the evening. But good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity. And I do want to give a genuine thank you to this board, because I call you my original board, basically, because when I got here in 2010 and there was a little bit of shuffling around, I'm the one who's worked with you the most from the school board office. And so I thank you. I thank you for that. What I'm going to do is go through, and I've given you a hard copy, and actually I have a few extra hard copies, maybe two or three if anyone would like to grab one beside Ms. Carr. Ms. Carr, I think there may be three there, if you'd like to see that. Some of the things I will go through pretty quickly, because it's updates you've seen, but I'll do some highlights. And then, of course, if you have questions, be glad to answer any questions. You have seen our mission and our vision, and I'm not going to read that to you. I think that that's been pretty clear. We have stuck by our four strategic priorities, and those were adopted by our school board in July of 2011. And it was the first time actually in a while that Fluvanna County School Board had worked together to specify what do we want to accomplish, what are our priorities for this school system. And from those priorities, we have built all of our advisory teams, project teams, et cetera, and our focus. Being involved, you have seen this information before. The newest piece is the school safety and security piece. We are required now to have a school safety and security committee. And, of course, through other forums, we have had discussions about safety issues in schools and have made efforts in the past to make sure that we have safe buildings and facilities and practices. But I will tell you, through the efforts through the Virginia Department of Education and actually the state, our work with their local law enforcement agency, I believe we are in a very good place to be able to articulate, and you'll see more of this even through the budget process, be able to articulate what we believe goes very well and how we are much more prepared even for a crisis, much better training. And I give kudos to Sheriff Washington for his work with us, because I approached him probably simultaneously. He approached me when I came in 2010, and we've worked real closely together on that. Project teams, just another, maybe a sweeter name for a committee. That's what I would call that. The reason project teams tends to flow a little more nicely in the education world is because you focus on specific initiatives year to year. And those initiatives have some short-term goals and that are pretty attainable in a year, and then they can move on to build on those goals. And I believe you've seen that language before, but we've found some pretty good success with using that form of getting input and getting people to roll up their sleeves and help us. Parent Advisory and Outreach Council remains strong, and so does the Staff Advisory Council. I'm primarily responsible for the formalized meetings with my parent advisory and outreach council, as well as staff advisory. At a minimum, I meet with my staff advisory on a monthly basis, sometimes two or three times, but typically monthly, and parent advisory every other month, typically, but we've met every month this year since school began. Committees, again, I won't read all that to you, but I would appreciate if you took time to look through that. Of course, our primary responsibility is to provide quality instruction, and that's to every single child, not just the children who are pretty easy to teach, and not just the children who come ready for school, because we live in a world, and we see this in Fluvanna, where there's a pretty big gaping hole between the have and the have-nots, and quite often the have-nots, the more poverty-stricken children do come to school, not with less care and love from their families, but quite often with less foundation for where they need to be. So we've got to remember that. Again, we work together with education technology. That's a required committee through our school board office and through VSBA. Superintendent's Advisory Council, you've seen that, and those are primarily our focus areas. Student service, athletics, and activities. All of those groups do involve themselves every year, and especially in the summer, using data and planning for the next year as to what the focus needs to be. And we pull a lot of information, everything from attendance patterns to discipline procedures. And not always as important is the number of disciplinary concerns, but the nature of the concerns. We look real closely at those and engage our counseling department, psychologists, social workers, et cetera, to look at where do we see trends with our students, how can we intervene, and how can we educate our children, because I believe discipline is a teaching process, and we educate our children to get what they need in different ways in terms of civility, etc. Health and wellness is another focus, certainly a huge need, not only for all of us, but, and that's, by the way, not a criticism of anybody's BMI. That is a focus that is so needed, because when you teach those healthy habits with children, they tend to continue those things. Our schools, West Central Primary, and I apologize, I noticed when I got here that I didn't write that West Central Primary is the home for our early childhood special education program, Head Start, and pre-K program. And we have about 235 students, and this is the data as of about 3 days ago. Central Elementary is first and second grade, 524 students. Carysbrook, third and fourth, 586. Fluvanna Middle is 5 through 7, a little over 800 students. And Fluvanna High School, 8 through 12, 1,425 students. Right now, total enrollment, and that's a number like warm bodies, is 3,612. And what you're going to find, you're going to see some contradictions in slides, and I'll explain those as we go through, because you should remember, enrollment, warm bodies, is different than ADM, average daily daily membership, because ADM determines their finances and their funding. Pre-K, we have 66 students currently enrolled, and we don't factor them in for funding purposes, because we don't count them as ours, because typically you have federal funds who assist us with that program. For the projected enrollment for this year, our budget is based on 3,636 students. That is the governor's budget. That did not change for the entire duration, even into the General Assembly. So we use that number. That's common for schools to do that. But that's what we based our budget on. Average people, teacher ratios, and this again is very average. Elementary school 1 to 21, middle 1 to 23, high school 1 to 26. But I will tell you, we're currently monitoring. We do have some high school classes with 35 plus students based on some shifts in courses and using a teacher to start the ag program this year certainly has a ripple effect other places. And we look real closely at those schedules, make sure we're still offering a diverse group of courses for our students, but not overloading on a consistent basis. 35 students in a gym class may be okay, you know, on most days. 35 students in a class where there's a lot of writing and a lot of feedback required from the teacher in an expedited way could cause some difficulties. Demographics, you've seen this as well on our fact sheet. And by the way, I will provide you an updated fact sheet. I'll send that to you electronically. We just finished updating the information. It gives a good dashboard look at what our school, who is in our school and what our school thought about. American Indian, excuse me, less than 1%, Asian, less than 1%. Black population, 15%, white, 73%. A little bit of a change, you know, over the years. Native Hawaiian, less than 1%, two or more. That's when students may select or parents may select two or more ethnicities, and that's about a 6.3%. Economically disadvantaged is right around 29%. That's a little, it's creeping up a little bit, and that's it comes from our free and reduced lunch rates. As accurate as any school system can have it be, because you will find, even with a lot of outreach and a lot of working with parents, typically when students get older, they're not interested in making sure that form gets home to the parents, and we can understand that. So we've been a little creative in the past 2 years to get those numbers and get the children what they need. Special education right now, 441 identified students. That's a little. I guess that's around 12%. 504 plans, those are plans for students, and that's a really, it's really a nice opportunity, really, because you could have a student who was in an automobile accident and had to be hospitalized for 6 weeks and needed a 504 plan to address those short-term medical issues where we could offer some extra support through a plan, but we also can offer support for a little diverse way to test that child if it's during an SOL time. Had a student last 2 years ago break her arm right before SOL writing test. And so, yes, she was much more concerned about it than any adult, for sure. But this is where this comes into play. And then, of course, there are other students who might not meet criteria for a full special ed program but could use some interventions that are specific to their needs, maybe ADHD as an example. Gifted students, 220, and LEP students, 53. Thing I want to tell you about gifted students, and we just started this year, we are doing, we're using, it's called a Naglieri, and it's a nonverbal assessment, and we're going to use that for every first grader. And I think that's just really wise because, and we're going to use it in the middle of the year. It's really hard when you look at your gifted students, gifted identified students, and see for years and years, quite honestly, that many of them are the same color. And I think that we have to be better, the adults have to be better at seeking out that creativity in their children. And testing children when they walk right back into the school, especially students that don't have as many resources, they may be some of the most creative minds you'd ever know, but it's not going to show up on a test. And I do, I applaud Fluvanna and our system and our staff for moving toward really reaching out to see what we need to do to enrich that population of students. Average daily membership, if you look way over to the right, 2014, those projections are the Virginia Department of Ed projections, and those projections are 3,710 that you notice is way different than what we're seeing in warm bodies. But again, when you look at ADM, that's a formulaic approach to funding, and those numbers are going to differ. But these are projections that we still have to use and to watch as we plan for budget. Student performance. Some highlights. This year, all of our schools are fully accredited, with the exception of the middle school. The middle school is accredited, but with a warning in math. Had a really tough time with the new test. I can truly say they have already rolled their sleeves up and are well on their way with that. I don't see that as being a long-term issue. Lots and lots of school systems had difficulty with the new math test.
Could you talk about the middle school?
Yes.
The incentive that they've been given, and that I think that's really important.
Yes, and that's actually on another slide but I don't mind talking about that because it fits well right here, Mr. Weaver. We wrote for a grant, and I will tell you, I've told my staff this, I am not an advocate for pay for performance, what I would say the traditional mindset, meaning you meet this mark, you get $3,000. I am an advocate, though, for incentivizing people to think differently by doing two things. One is to incentivize them to be involved with research, book studies, sharing their expertise, collaborative models of instruction. And then from that, you will see gains with students. And so what we did, we really knew when we wrote for that grant it was very unique, but we just stuck by our beliefs that you just don't want to say, oh, great job because you had this result, this one little number, because that one little number is only one indicator. We were real creative about involving professional development in that, book studies, giving our teachers resources, having them also work as a team. Because if I was the PE teacher and you were the social studies teacher, or I was the PE teacher and maybe a coach, there's no way to discriminate that little Ed Breslauer did well in your class because of you. He may have done well in your class because I told him on the football field, you're not playing unless you do well in that class. So it's so convoluted and not really black and white. So we wrote it so that not only the typical core teachers in math, science, social studies, and language arts could be incentivized and receive a stipend, a small stipend, but so could the PE teacher. What if the PE teacher became really savvy, and they have become savvy, at literacy and strategies to teach children how to comprehend material. And they became part of a team that helped tutor. So we created it so that really every single staff member who has a license, so it wouldn't be an instructional aide, which is unfortunate because I think it would be good to include them as well, but every staff member at the middle school has a license has the ability to receive that kind of stipend. We were really, really excited about that. And one of 13 systems in the state that received that.
I'll be interested in seeing the results on that too.
Me too.
Yes.
Me too. But thank you for asking that. And Carisbrook Elementary, I should have actually, that's the thing that should have been all in bold, bright red letters, something, because Carisbrook Elementary School met all of the federal AMOs, the annual measurable objectives. They met all of those marks this year, and that's the first time in 6 years.
Wow.
And that's after 2 years of very, very intense work with literacy partners. And because of some other quirky things going around the state with measurements, that was not, that to me, that has to be said over and over. Kudos to them. On-time graduation rate continues to be really good, and I'll tell you two things that impact that. One, you have to have a school and a culture where children want to come. Students have to want to be there. And if they don't want to be there, the second thing you have to have is adults who are willing to go grab them and say, you need to be here. So, we got a deal for you. Dropout rate continues to be a good rate. Of course, we'd like to see zero. You know, we would like to see none, but that's going to ebb and flow. Points of pride, parent-led initiatives. We continued the Destination Imagination program. I know you've seen press releases on that. This year we created the Lego League. We actually have a robot available for the 7th grade science courses, which is really, really exciting. I think the robot, I don't think he or she's here yet, but any day. The PTO and parent advisory councils continue to be very, very strong at each of our schools. Very, very pleased with our parents. Definitely not going to read all that to you, so no worries. Strategic planning continues. Anytime that you develop a strategic plan, we must look at our data every year, and we do that during the summer. Work with administrators, our school board. We also invite our staff in each year to really comb through and take a hard look. I would say a brutally honest look at where we are and what we need to do. And I'm proud of the things that we've been able to do in this realm as well. If you look about a third of the way down the bullet list, I will say, though, where it says professional development, there were several of us, I will say three of us in particular, who spent about 2 weeks, no kidding, on the phone with people from the State Department of Education and a particular person who represents all of the federal grants that come through the state. And I'm not going to say we were begging, because that's not a pretty trait to have, but I'm going to say we were very adamant that the funds that we had carried through from our teacher evaluation pilot and what we would call leftover, we were very adamant that it made sense to take those funds and turn them around and use them to provide professional development opportunities in the areas that were cited in the data where we needed help. And they couldn't even argue that. I love it when you can make people stammer when they have a lot of money.
They did it?
We got it. Oh, yes, we got it. Professional development, one of the things we use is PD 360. You can actually get online and look at that. It is a phenomenal resource. It's like all of the research you could ever want in education, little online videos. You can get recertification points, lots of modules. It's amazing. It also offers our teachers an opportunity to blog across the nation with other teachers who are experiencing similar things. And so it's really, really good. And we were able to take that money and pay for PD360 for 3 years up front. So that's really, really nice. And kudos to the State Department of Ed for bearing with us through all that, but we got it. Focus discussions, and you know we have, again, not going to read that, but very, very proud of the bottom, growing as a community of thinkers and learners. And watching the school system grow is, if you think about it, when I have other superintendents who come, and I host meetings for Region 5 superintendents, usually once a year, but what's really impressive is to have other people come and walk through and hear conversations, little blips of conversations, and it's like being away from, you know, probably your grandchild, and then coming back and going, oh my goodness, that child has grown so much. And so I want you to be proud of that, because I believe those efforts are huge. We still, no matter what we've been through, we still have very focused, committed staff. Points of pride, I'm going to read every one of those to you. I'm just kidding. If you look at the bottom, I do want to highlight the Battle of the Brains. We had a group of students. Oh, they just rocked. They got first place.
Oh, that's great.
First time, first place.
I did that when I was
in high school.
I bet you did, but I still bet it's better that they didn't have a security camera on a bus.
No, we won.
I bet it wasn't that long ago either.
History and
history. Well, there you go. In your off time, you can come help coach the kids.
Yeah.
It's
awesome. It's great.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. They are so excited.
Of course we did. We went to the regionals, the states, and all that.
All right. They had that back in the '80s too.
Yes, they did.
Is that still called the ACE?
Battle of the Brains. They call it the Battle of the Brains.
Okay, yeah. They call it back then. I went to a lot of those, and they were really good.
It's fascinating.
Yes.
I mean, it really is fascinating. And again, just it's the epitome of getting people together to figure out how can we meet the needs of lots of different children. Mr. Small. Mm-hmm.
No, definitely didn't have that in the 60s. I didn't qualify anyway.
You can keep score.
They were still trying to get that bus camera. That's what that was. The Fluvanna County Public Schools STEM and H, of course, with health occupations, and I definitely wouldn't read, but I would ask you to take time to look through this information. I've updated it so you know where we are in each of these realms this year, where we hope to be able to go. We're very fortunate to offer lots of opportunity for our students. It's just a different world. It is just a different world, even from when we were there. Future efforts, we definitely want to expand these opportunities. We want to look at more engineering opportunities, and I still do, and I will do this in the spring. I want to invite you to come to our engineering class. I want you to see the 3D printer. It's just fascinating. I mean, it's just amazing. And the reason I say next semester is because our teacher, when I said, I'd like to bring, he said, will you give me till next semester? Because, you know, they follow a very rigid program. And so I said, absolutely. We have explored STEM partnership with the University of Richmond and Longwood. Actually, we just found out that the University of Richmond, believe it or not, did not get enough takers for their partnership. We just found that out yesterday. I cannot believe that. However, we jumped right on the UVA because they turned around and invited us for one, so it's not a problem. But we continue to do that. We look for professional development opportunities through local universities. If you've read some information recently, you'll see that Longwood University, Radford University, we've got some smaller schools who are really, really being showcased for the work that they do with education, and that's phenomenal. So we latch on to people like that. Partner with school divisions and courses. We recently were able to, again, through funds through the Department of Ed that were, I called, leftover from a teacher evaluation pilot, we brought in a nationally recognized researcher and speaker named Donna Ford, who really advocates for minorities in gifted programs. And she was just phenomenal. And one of the hardest things that I think that we did, but I think it was smart to do, was I had her showcase our data. Now, I didn't showcase it to make anyone feel badly about it, but what happened was what I expected to happen. I had teachers come up afterwards and say, we can fix this. This is ridiculous. We can do more to get our children ready. And it's not just about being classified as gifted. It's high-performing children. It's children who are inquisitive and need to have opportunities that I don't think they're getting right now. Partnered with PVCC for adult learning. Those classes look to start in February and March, and I'll have more information about that soon. And we have already worked some details out with PVCC student enrichment summer camps next year, and we've reached out to Goochland as well. They may join us with some of the things. And summer camps would be available for all children in Fluvanna, whether they're in our school system or homeschooled or not. That needs to be for all of our children. Regional partnerships, you've seen that before. I think you're familiar with PREP, Project Return, Blue Ridge Virtual Governor's School. Current budget status, that shows, and that's at the bottom, you know what our state, local, federal, other local supplement, if you look at that, all of those were, that's grant money brought forth, basically, and we had to expend those funds by September 30th. Now, that was some work. That took some work, because if you think about it, you spend it first, you spend it, then you get it reimbursed. So there was a lot of work behind that. The one, $180,000 was VPSA, $280,000 was the school improvement Title I money. Families learning together, very proud of those ladies continuing their efforts for our English language learners, and we still have significant enough amount of families who need that kind of support. And then at the bottom, the $147,063, that's the teacher evaluation pilot money.
Do you have to spend all of that this year?
Yes.
You do.
Okay. It's done.
Oh, all right. It's done.
Okay. And as you notice, it's not about stuff. It's really, yeah. I mean, things that are visible.
Right.
Being able to replace laptops, being able to, we're actually for the first time since I've been here, and I think what I heard was the first time in 6-7 years, we're actually taking 20 staff members to a conference that's one of the best ones in the state of Virginia, because the Department of Ed allowed us to use their money for that because it's a recognized conference. I mean, that sounds like a simple thing, but it's so huge for our staff to be able to network and learn for lots of reasons, and you know that. You know what those are. Current status, here's where we are this year. The fiscal year budget was based on an ADM of 3636. Currently, we have 3,612 students. However, remember, your warm bodies is going to be different than your projected ADM. October 1st is your first report goes to the state projecting an ADM, and our ADM at that point, end of September, October 1st, was 3,562 students. March 1st is the key, because March 1st is when they determine at the state what the actual funding is based on your ADM. So we watch this. I will say we watch this day to day. Now, we've always watched it, but what's concerning for us is to see dips in our enrollment, primarily in kindergarten. We've seen less students enroll this year in kindergarten. The potential financial impact, if we said, okay, we're at the end of the year right now, when we talk about a financial impact, you're talking about $300,000 less than right now than what we would expect from the state that's been appropriated. The next piece to this, the health insurance, and I'll talk about how we're managing that right now. I saw you hold your neck.
Can you give some timing on that?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. The March 1st. When we watch this month to month, March 1st is the final ADM. That's when the ADM report, that's when our reports go in, they calculate. The couple good news things is that the State Department of Ed have people that they didn't have last year to help counties with this. Waynesboro suffered a situation very similar to ours. I mean, literally blindsided almost, because we're doing our calculations in hours. We're going to calculate a little bit high that we think could be a deficit. But March 1st is going to be the key. when those reports go in. And typically, Ed, when that happens, is it in April when we...
You see when the bushwhack happens, though? The state comes in and says, well, we expect you to have 3,700 students, and your actual total is that?
Well, that's the numbers I called about today, because I'm worried about timing.
And on top of that, they announce 8 a.m. the same moment they get to call. So,
yes.
But you did say in this last budget that you had overestimated, therefore we had a shortfall.
In this
on ADMs.
It's not our overestimation. It is it's from the governor's budget and then from video. We
I know, but if you put in your budget that you're going to get this much from the state.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I don't know a school system that wouldn't use.
Right.
You have to use that. You're right. So you say we based a budget on 3636. That's that went all the way through the General Assembly, meaning that was the project. That was the ADM for Fluvanna County.
But with your composite index this time, is it not possible that composite index will drop because of the reassessment? Mm-hmm. Therefore, the composite...
Yeah. That's
one of the basis that composite index
but
is
we're
used.
We're working on 2009's
right.
composite index.
Right.
That last
it
year
lags.
Will not come up until...
Every 2 years.
2016, it won't come up where we reassess.
Right.
It won't come up until 20.
So I guess my basic question to prepare for this is this a $300,000 requirement this fiscal year?
It could be if we don't have any students. Right. It could be. But March 1st is going to be, we'll watch it, and it's a slide in here too. I would imagine we would continue to meet on a monthly basis. We report it in our board report every month, our projections.
That's the concern. The I mean, if you go back, if you go back on one slide, now, this is the budget, the state, the local portion, the 13,751.
Right.
Sooner or later, someplace in this state number, the 18,674, if it's $300,000
less,
right.
The budget's already three quarters of the way through the year. By the time you know that, you can't back up and say, oh, by the way, I'm not going to spend that money that I already spent. So the $300,000 is going to be a due bill that you don't have any choice on. But we better be planning for $300,000 if there's a potential due bill due.
And the other part of that is with our meetings, we also are planning for that. I mean, meaning we have, for example, instructional supplies funds, we divided. If you look at the budget document that we have, and if you've seen it, we divide it where it has, say, Carrie's book. It'll say instructional supplies for Carrie's book. But right under that, there's a line that says division level supplies because we withheld some just in case. Now, it doesn't mean we have $300,000 there because we don't have that kind of a budget. But we were, I think, wise about planning the what ifs, and we would just have to month to month.
And this is something that we discussed last week, so the potential is the emphasis, but financial impact is the fact. So,
right,
it could be as high as 300,000, but we're not going to know until the Commonwealth.
But it's financial pressures. If you're going through budget season coming up, and there's going to be a requirement for 300K or some small amount, whatever the dollar happens to be, because we're not funded, that you're going to have to find the funds from someplace, and that can impact on what you're doing on CIP or come taking out of the fund balance, or a variety of things.
But why don't you underestimate it, and that way you're safe, and then if it comes in more, then you're all right. Underestimate what you are going to get from the state. This last time you overestimated what we were going to get from the state, and we were short, as Mr. Nichols says. So why not underestimate it? That's what historically that the school division had done, was underestimated, and we usually got more, and we never had that problem.
No, they decide what you get. We don't.
Well, she can make her budget up. I mean, the school board
can
make
the number,
budget, whatever.
Not,
but they
just
look
the number.
At the ADM.
Yeah, but how would they determine that, though, Mr. Weaver?
If you think it's going to be this, and you're guessing, you can drop below it and use that figure. Then that's the way.
But I think that's what they do. It's
this budget this year that didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean we had this conversation last year where the Commonwealth artificially set us high, knowing that it was going to drop. So I mean, right. You can kind of guesstimate where that ADM is going to be,
right.
But until you get the actual numbers, you're not going to know.
That's
the actual numbers could be, I mean, be a mass exodus from Fluvanna County, and then what do you do? Or it could be a new development that comes in overnight, and you know, you got 50 new kids to put into your public school system. I mean, you don't know that ADM until.
And that ADM is lower than what was prior. I mean,
yeah,
that
exactly.
that was a drop.
Yeah, I mean,
so,
we're seeing a drop in student attendance, but there are still fixed costs embedded within that. It's I mean, and being a smaller locality, it's a lot harder to absorb.
Well, to my point, it's not that this is not a valid number or that it's not going to be a valid requirement. It's just that somebody's going to ask the county administrator to ask the finance director to find money to be able to cover it, and I just want to be prepared for it, whatever the numbers are.
And there's no way to improve the ADM by March.
Only if more students.
Only if the attendance.
Sure, if you have more students.
If we have 96% attendance now.
No. It's the actual students who come.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
Right.
If you don't have
it's not the percentage of attendance. It's who comes.
How many kids are there?
Right.
Okay.
That's right. How
so
many kids are there?
Well, still, if you had all the kids came for a month, you wouldn't have to worry about it because your ADM would be high.
Well, I'll tell you, it's an average daily membership, and there's a formula to that.
Right.
The other piece, though, I'll tell you what we're really looking at, too, is that often things are out of our hands,
mm-hmm.
in that we have right now a significant number of students. I'd say significant number of students who are now to county placements for issues that we have nothing to do with.
Right.
We lose them. We lose. Now they can return and help us, but you lose that, and it impacts your average daily membership.
So you don't count the CSA kids. Or in residential placements?
No, they don't.
They're not counting.
No, they'd have to be in our system full time.
And this gate swings both ways. I mean, in the good years, quote unquote, mm-hmm. when you're putting $700,000-$800,000 into the general fund because of cost overruns, we get the benefit side of it too at times. It's
right.
Just we're still coming out of that trough, and so that's where, and it's a bit of a catch-22 for the school system because. When they come back with $700,000, we always say, well, why did you budget for that much if you didn't need it? And when it comes in lower, it's, why didn't you over budget in order to compensate? So it's a bit of it's just the funny way that Virginia does budgeting, and there's not much sympathy for how it's done on the outside world looking in, but it's just reality.
You remember the chart you showed for 2014? It had 3,700 some kids. Now, what is that right here?
Yeah.
It's a very low.
That's a projection.
That's the projection from the Department
of
Education.
From the Department of Education.
But if their funding's based on that projection,
we're
in big trouble.
And then we come up with 36.
Well, actually, no. If their funding's based on that, that's great.
If their funding's based on that, we're in big trouble because the ADM won't come out to be
37.10. No, if they're funding based on that, that's great. If the ADM comes in lower than that, that's where you're in trouble.
That's where you're
in trouble. If they're projecting that and they give us that, that's outstanding.
That'd be fantastic,
Right, but that's not, right, and that's not what we use.
It never happens that way. So.
Well, and to my point, I'm not suggesting this is not a valid number, or I'm just suggesting that
I'm kind of on your line.
Some years it's good, some years it's bad, but you know there's going to be adjustments.
We'll
you kind of have to build into your planning the need that sometimes you might get some money back, sometimes you got to pay more, and you can't be surprised or worried or mad in March when you find out, it's just fact.
Yeah, and it's important for the outside world who does not understand such things. This is not an instance where you're underfunding or overfunding education.
Right.
It is simply the way the Virginia budgeting process works.
Right.
Sure.
And I just like to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So. Right, and that's why that's up there.
Okay.
Health insurance claims run out. We have moved out of the self-insurance world and very happy to do that. We budgeted $294,000 for run out and then have already, and I'm expecting that this is the last bit, we've had to add $250,000 to those health insurance claims run out. And that's specific to people's health insurance claims. Mm-hmm. Not a lot you can do about that either.
Is that another possible shortage?
That's something that we've been able to manage and think we could manage. I'm more I'm probably most concerned about the ADM piece.
All right.
Do you agree with that, Ed? Thank you, Ed.
My special friend.
So do you have any, we don't have a fitness program in the school system yet.
No, but we're signing up for the Move to Health. That's okay. The regional program where right. You log in, et cetera, et cetera. But I will tell you on a little bit of link to your question is that we're going to offer a health fair for our staff this year.
Good.
Already started getting that organized where they can get free cholesterol checks, free, et cetera. I think, and that's something we could probably even do together.
Well, we do one because we use the same health insurance now. So maybe we want to partner on that because we did one last year.
Love to talk with you, but we'll definitely talk.
Right, okay. And then eventually you can have some incentives when people have a good 3 out of 4, 5 out of 6 good health indicators. They get $100 on their insurance.
Well, we even looked at 2 years ago when we looked at health insurance plans, we created two premiums. I mean, that if there were people who were non-smokers or who had these health checks and committed to them, then they had a little bit nicer premium.
Right.
Enough to kind of draw their attention. And then we had to be careful about, you know, of course, always what's legal and what you can offer and what you can't. But the point is, it was we were working really hard to have a wellness plan. So,
but
certainly.
That takes a person and time.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Budget planning, we have just, actually as of this morning, started the full efficiency study. I won't read all of those, but what I did is I thought it would be important for you to see the categories that they look at. And I've been through an efficiency study one time in my life in education, and it's a mind-boggling process, but can be very, very helpful for us. But the second bullet up there where it says the three-year story, That's important. It gives us a chance to talk about our school system. And if you think about it and look back, I came in the fall of 2010, and every year we have opened a new system, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Every year. Mm-hmm. You open a school, restructure, move children, close two schools. And so there's been so much that has gone on. I think it's going to be interesting to get their perspective, and they clearly are very professional, bright people from the Department of Ed and the State Department of Budget and Planning. Budget focus, we're planning for an impact of, we want to look at salaries. I'll talk to you about that in just a second. Certainly health insurance. Interestingly enough, we're looking at what it would cost to tier our contribution, because right now we give a flat rate. And Mr. Breslar had said that just recently when he went to a meeting, there is the opposite conversation going across the state, across region, that people don't want to tier health insurance contributions. They want to give a flat rate just because of the cost. And so we also, maybe like you, have been in lots of meetings and discussions about the impact of the new health insurance plans and regs and when they actually hit, and we're definitely following that real closely. VRS, you guys have already mentioned that. We definitely have an impact right now. It looks to be, about a $400,000 increase just off the top for us to take on the increase in VRS. Staffing needs, we'll continue to look at those. I will tell you, staffing needs, my biggest concern right now is the high school. They're probably as close to SOQs as maybe they could possibly be, and a little concerned about what that can do for coursework. ADM, we've already talked about that, and certainly we'll watch that closely and check, keep close watch on that. And I will say about the ADM, there are a couple realities. One is parents have more choice. Parents have more choices. It used to be every child went to public school, it used to be that certain children went to public schools and everybody else stayed home. Then it was, with the Compulsory School Act, all children come to public schools, and now parents have more choices. And that in itself is, that's something that's really hard to predict. And so, but we've got to be smart about, again, really to what Mr. Weaver was speaking about, is where do you find that balance? And, you know, how do you budget? And, again, it's If I have 17 children or 28 in a class, I still need a teacher. So I have to budget for that. The salary scales, let me tell you something we're looking at. And tomorrow evening at 5:30, our school board has a work session. What we're looking at as a possibility, and again, this is very preliminary, is starting next year to run two salary scales, and I'll tell you why. Our 0 through 7 people right now, our people who are on the 0 through 7, have made the same amount of money that many years. They all get paid the exact same. That's, I would say, hideous, and we have got to get out of that. We have got to, and I'll tell you, Mr. Breslau did a really good job because I could not stand to be in there crunching the numbers that he has to crunch. I give him the ideas, and he goes on down the hall. I think I heard him mumble a few times. Did you mumble? It was louder than that. But what we've done is looked at, what if we took the 0 through 7 people who've been the same? You know, they've made the same $50 for 7 years. And what if, as they entered their 8th year, they started a new scale, and I believe I've shown you a chart like this before, that's much more sustainable, that doesn't do what the old chart, what the old salary scale has done, not the chart, which is stay a little bit, bump, stay a little bit, big bump. You cannot afford those. I mean, there are very, very few systems who can afford that kind of hit and try to predict that kind of hit. It's huge. I started teaching with salary scales like that, where you waited till the 12th year because you knew you were going to get a $4,500 increase. But then it changed.
But that was the purpose of doing it.
There was, of course,
but
this purpose.
We don't have that purpose today.
Exactly. It's a different world.
Right.
And I think better business sense would tell you that you don't operate like that. So what we were doing is looking at a salary scale that would push them into a new scale that is an increase, a bit of an increase every year if it's a cost of living or whatever it is. And that's predictable. And we all know that salary scales can move up, shift based on the economy. Our people who enter their 9th year would be grandfathered into the scale that exists now, except where those bumps occur, instead of that big jump in 1 year, it would be spread over 2 or 3 years. Making it much more manageable. Mr. Breslau, like I said, has done a really good job. Actually, the documents are online right now. I don't mind sending them to you, Mr. Nicholson, if you want to give them to the rest of the board, because it gives a good look at lifetime earnings, what the differences are. They're public documents. They're already out anyway, but I can slip them to you. Remember to send those to you. But we'll be discussing those tomorrow. Now, as with anything, anytime you talk about salary scales, there's a lot of trepidation in the hearts of the people. I will tell you, and for the record, I think it's important, I spent a lot of time, and so did Mr. Breslau, with our principals, explaining, talking through this. We met with our staff advisory council. I sent information out. Actually, I did share that with Mr. Nichols. Sent information that gave an overview of the purpose behind that. And no one takes a hit. I mean, no one loses, other than people who could say, well, wait a minute, if I'd stayed on what we call the legacy scale, I would have been here. The reality is, when you look at the local composite index, which really equates to your ability to pay, we are third in terms of pay. We got Albemarle, Charlottesville, and then Flavanna, but we're about fifth or sixth in terms of the LCI and what we're supposed to be paying. And for lack of a better way to say it, and there's not a derogatory remark, sometimes we've lived beyond our means, and we've got to do things to restructure and still be competitive, and I think that's a doable thing to do. And again, preliminary discussions with the board. Continued conversations, I would hope and expect that we would get to continue to meet. Ms. Washington, Mr. Kinney, myself, Mr. Nichols have met pretty much on a monthly basis, not to make any decisions, but to really ask questions, and it's helped me learn a lot about the county processes, and hopefully it's helped them engage them in conversations about schools. School budgeting, the 101, which now might be the 201, with Mr. Breslau this year, he's going to continue that, has started that, and is going to continue it about 30, 45 minutes before each school board meeting, so people who want to come and join us would be there. And just for the future, these are two things I think that are very important to say. The first one is we must educate our children for the future, not in a way that holds them hostage to only what we know, because they're going to know much more than we can ever know. But we've got to lift them into a place that we envision. And that sounds really bumper stickerish, but I really do believe it. We cannot educate our children in a world that we live in. We have to be such visionaries. And the other thing that I think is very true and speaks to so many things that people wrestle with, whether it's school systems, businesses, etc., is that change is hard. But people typically, and I believe this, they overestimate the value of what they have and underestimate the value of what they may gain by giving that up and moving forward. And I think that forces us to be really, really creative. And with that, I say thank you for giving me the time. And unless there's a question, I do have one more little thing.
Yes, ma'am.
A question? Anybody question?
Any questions from the board?
How is it ag program?
Wonderful, and you must buy their apple butter.
Oh, okay.
Kids love it. And we have, I tell you, we stole him right out of Louisa. I had to call Deb Pettit, superintendent, and I say, she goes, I know why you're calling. Don't even talk to me.
Okay, so we're one for one.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
And mutual
if,
aid.
Yeah, there you go. If there's anything that can always put it in perspective, when you go home tonight and you get on and, you know, you look, oh, I don't know what your homepage is, but in MSN sometime I look at that and say, but I have to share this with you because it puts everything in perspective. No matter what you deal with, this puts it in perspective. There is on the internet a shared letter from a young boy to a young girl, and it goes like this. And it says, Dear Ashley, would you please be my girlfriend? And you have to circle yes, no, or maybe. Please put yes, no, or maybe. So she circles no. And she said, I'm sorry, I already have a boyfriend, Kyle, but when we break up, you're my next choice.
Yeah.
And that will probably be in the next month or two.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, when you're down and out about budget, just remember what really matters. So thank you.
Yes, ma'am, thank you. Moving on to the consent agenda, the minutes of our October 16th accounts payable resolution regarding recognizing outstanding conservation farm. Rural Rustic Road resolutions and open space applications. Is there any item that needs to be pulled? I know we want to discuss tab G, Mr. Weaver.
Yes. Well, F with the minutes. Yeah, and she has already made the corrections.
Right, the minutes, you asked to have the FUSD loan, the $30,000 FUSD loan, an annotation made out that that's at the 0% interest loan.
Right.
And we'll add that to the minutes.
Okay, that takes care of that.
I think it's important that we just... I know we're recognizing the outstanding conservation farm, but I think we really should recognize that as a big deal.
Well, at your next meeting on November 20th, we're actually going to do the presentation that evening.
Okay.
We're doing the paperwork now, but the people will be here at the November 20th, and so Solomonic Conservation folks and the I think the family will be here. Is that evening, the 20th, Mary, for the recognition for the Modesto farm?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Oh, it is Modesto.
Right. And what did you say about the council payable? What was it you just said?
Oh, no, nothing. I was okay. The other thing was this. I've got an AP pulled up if you want.
Tab G, Mr. Cooper.
Huh?
What, tab G. Are you good with the accounts payable?
I don't have any accounts payable.
Yes, we do.
Oh, we sent it to you separate.
Okay, I missed it then.
It probably didn't come out to you in hard copy. I'm sorry. It came by
electronic.
It came out by email.
I didn't see it on my iPad. I looked.
We had a problem with the Munis system. We just didn't get it. We just couldn't get it in the package initially. So
it was in the share file.
Yeah.
We sent it to you.
Well, I don't.
Yeah. Perhaps we need to defer tab G to next meeting then, because
I'm sure Mr. Weaver wants so it.
I think it's good to go. No.
So we will defer tab G.
Okay.
So we'll withdraw tab G from the consent agenda and defer to the meeting of the
20th. Share file.
So, without further objection, somebody be so kind as to move the consent agenda.
So may.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Ullenbrock. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. One matter of unfinished business, Central Meadows Conservation Easement, Mr. Payne.
Mr. Chairman, I've never had this come up before, but I thought it was something that I needed to have your guidance on, and that is the Central Meadows Conservation Easement. When the matter came to you initially, it had attached to it a draft easement, and you approved it subject to my approval of the terms of the deed. As I was reading the terms of the deed, there were several problems, and nothing of any earth-shaking importance, but there were things that needed to be changed. And I reviewed it and sent those comments back, and they responded to my comments. Some of them there were a couple of incorrect statutory citations and things like that just were clerical in nature. there are one or two of them that they haven't addressed, and I think that's purely an oversight, although I'm not sure about that. The one that really gave me concern was this issue of the construction on the properties subject to the easement. And I sent you all a memorandum on this, giving you the details. I want you to know that I am not advocating either position, but I wanted to point out to you that what this did in effect was that it had about, I'm going to make up a number, I think it was 600 acres, something like 600 acres, but it consisted of five different parcels, and they varied in size from, I think it's 42 acres to something like 260 acres. Four of the five are significantly in excess of 100 acres. The reason I flagged the issue in the first place was that the language was somewhat inconsistent in their draft, but what it seemed to be saying was that when it outlined what improvements could be made on the property, one of the things it addressed was residential uses. And it said one primary residence and not more than two secondary dwelling units. And then a secondary dwelling unit is something like a mother-in-law apartment or a guest house or something like that. I looked at that and said, this is going to be odd because it appears to say that you can only have one primary dwelling unit and two secondary units on the whole property. That's 600 and some acres. The way they had it worded, that's what it said to me, but there was some ambiguity in that because some of the sections didn't exactly match up. So I asked them to address that and make it clear what they were talking about. Now, what I thought they were going to do was make it clear they were talking about one dwelling unit on the whole property. Instead, what they did was they made it clear that they were talking about one dwelling per parcel. And there were five. There are five now. The proposed easement deed permits them to rearrange the property line so they end up with not more than six. Now, the ordinance requires that if there's to be divisions, it can't be into less than 100-acre parcels. The deed appears to be consistent with that. The ordinance doesn't say how many dwelling units, if any, you can put on either the whole thing or any one parcel. So we don't have an easy bright line to talk about. The issue, I think, is for you, and that is, how do you construe the thrust of the program? And what I mean by that is it your intent that residential parcels, or parcels which can be used for residential purposes, are to be limited to 100 acres, not less than 100 acres, or is it your intent that in the case of a property which is being subjected to this easement, that essentially the status quo is maintained? That is not more than one parcel per the whole, not one more residence for the whole thing. It's not an insignificant decision in this case, because if you decide the former, that is, as they're proposing, one dwelling unit per 100 acres, then you got a minimum of six and a maximum of 18. That is one primary and two secondaries per parcel. If you want it to be one per property that's subject to the easement, then it would be one plus two, or three, a total of three. I think you can see what my concern is, and I didn't want to make that decision without having your guidance as to what you intended. Now, let me say two other things to guide your view of this. Number one, this is not like the typical decision you make, where you have guidance on things. You have to make sure that you're treating people according to an established set of rules, like a special use permit or a rezoning or something like that. it's entirely clear to me that the enabling legislation and the ordinance put whether or not, put the decision whether to or not to accept such an easement solely in your discretion. So you have the right to say, I don't think this fits our plan, we're not going to approve it. Or we think our plan allows such and such and we'll approve that. So this is a matter that I believe is purely within the range that we're talking about here in your discretion.
So property is already subdivided into, what, five lots, is that correct?
I wouldn't call it subdivided. It's not, there has
parcels, right?
There's five parcels that were accumulated to make this one, which has been submitted for the easement.
And the applicant wants to be able to say that he can put a structure on each parcel.
That's correct. Well, it's not only each of those five, but to create one more.
Plus outbuildings.
I'm sorry?
Plus two outbuildings.
No, I wouldn't use the term outbuildings because the words we're talking about are secondary residential buildings.
Right.
And it's defined in terms of area and the use and stuff like that. Outbuildings, I would include things that are non-residential,
and
barns. And
is that per parcel?
I'm sorry?
Per parcel.
That's the issue. It doesn't. So
how many parcels?
I don't have a concern
six.
At all.
Well,
looks to me like six. When he combined all of those parcels together.
I don't have a problem.
That would be
I don't
the main.
Because it's a small scale.
Residential place.
One
plus, like you say, for the,
acres? I mean,
it's for the parents or something like that. That was the intent.
It would be one building, like whatever outbuildings or whatever.
It,
it's like
it
for
could
a
be
farm or something.
But I know what you're talking about with the five parcels.
Which would be
one
land
one.
Use. Yeah. I mean,
well,
so
I have no problem because it's
smart. Let me say that in terms, we don't have a whole lot of history on this because we haven't had that many parcels, haven't had that many easements. None of them has fit this mold. They've all been either small parcels that aggregate up to 100 or a more or less 100-acre parcel, something like that. So the issue hasn't arisen. Clearly, if this were a 100-acre parcel, let me put it another way. There's one parcel that's less than 100 acres. It's 42 acres. Leaving that one aside, if the applicant had come in with separate applications for each parcel, then your choice would be clear.
Sure.
The applicant didn't do that. The applicant aggregated this under one parcel. I think the language of the ordinance and the it can be read to permit either one. What I think what changes here is the language of the model deed, the model easement deed, which we didn't make up. We took it from the VOF model. And it suggests aggregating, that is one residence per aggregate property. It doesn't absolutely say that, and the ordinance doesn't require that you only use that. But so it's a matter of your discretion, how you think this should be administered. And I'm willing to do it either way you want.
My personal feelings on it, and it's in the Columbia district, but I don't have any problems. I mean, the purpose is, of course, to maintain it in land use. So that seems to be the very clear intent of the applicant. So I don't have any problem with five or six parcels at 100 acres, with a building on each one or whatever the case may be. That seems to be his pretty clear intent up front.
Now we'll tell you that one of them will be 40 acres.
Well, it might be just 10, but is that
but it's all on land
the county?
And, but it's all on land use, and that's the object of the ordinance.
Different.
Once it goes to conservation easement, isn't it almost perpetual?
For
all intents and
purposes, to get out of it essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. So to me, it just makes I don't see it as being problematic. That's my opinion on the matter, Mr. Allenbrook.
I'm also. Well, yeah, you.
I just kind of wondered, what's the purpose behind the conservation easement?
He could have done that before.
Rural character and to limit.
So all he would have, but he would have had to do five or six applications.
And by adding
so
that,
to me, it's just
allowing
not worth the angst.
That's not the point of conservation.
But if you put one residence on a 100-acre parcel,
that's a lot of.
That's pretty rural.
Yeah, that's pretty rural.
Are there any negatives to whatever we do?
I'm not sure.
Are there any
consequences or
consequences, or do we have to change
precedent?
the ordinance, or is the,
you don't have to change
never,
the ordinance?
But if we do this, it sets a basis.
Whatever you say today, I'm going to use the guide for reviewing future applications.
Okay, so it is important that we.
Well, it certainly, I'm sure it's important to the to the landowner.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Well, is it important? I don't have an issue with that.
I don't either. It's a small.
Three of us don't seem to have an issue. What are there any substantial overriding concerns?
I think the whole issue about protecting the real character.
Let me just say that Mr. Chesser is absolutely correct. That's exactly what this is about.
Yes.
The problem is, I remember one time Mr. Eager looked at somebody who's always talked about rural character and asked if that person was interested in coming over and helping him castrate rams, because that was rural character.
I got a knife.
That was the. The point is, we all agree that it's intended to preserve rural character. The question is what that means, and that's your role.
Yeah, and I think five individuals owning 100-acre lots does precisely that. As a matter of fact, it does it for more than just four.
But he combined them. That's the problem. You know, if he had presented them separately,
well, he didn't necessarily combine them, though. He just presented all five as one. I mean, if he had done five individual ones, this would not have been an issue.
That's right.
So, but I think his intent was clear. I think that I'm not too sure. It doesn't jeopardize the conservation easement or its role as land use. It's not like this is a sneaky way of creating development.
So if the entire county were divided up into 100-acre parcels and you put one house and two outbuildings, two associated buildings on each parcel, would we have rural character in our county?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would certainly think so from that perspective.
You would still have rural character. 100 acres is 100 acres.
But what was the intent?
Well, I don't know.
I think it means
I don't see
intent.
Any problem with it.
You don't see anything? Mrs. Booker doesn't see any problem with it?
Mr. Chairman,
I have
a question.
Mr. Sheridan, yes, sir.
Just from the commission's office.
Let me get you on the microphone.
My name is here for some reason.
I see all the conservation easements as they are after they are recorded, by and large. And they are all across the board, but by and large, they are done in 100-acre blocks. They're given that division right, but not entirely. There are some that are entirely put in with one dwelling.
Okay.
I don't want to comment. That's y'all's call. I just want to ask the question if a process, and the answer may be yes. I just need to know on the front end if there is a requirement for that, you know, professional appraisal of the property. Before the easement is done, because that professional appraisal that generally the applicant pays for, whether it's VOF or Ducks Unlimited, or, you know. If the answer is yes, that's good, because I need that, or the commissioner's office needs that.
Hold on just a minute. It is not required by our ordinance that there be a professional appraisal. There is going to be a professional appraisal because you don't get the tax benefit of imposing the easement. Yeah. So the landowner will certainly do that. But it's not a prerequisite for establishing the easement.
I think
for,
that answers your question.
That answers what I need. Yes is a good answer for me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sheridan.
The other consideration, too, is since this is property rights, the man should be able to do what he wants to with that land.
Amen.
I'm also thinking about property rights. All right, the conservation stays in place, gives him property rights, it allows him to do what he wants to. So give him, so he has that ability to do that.
If you want to think about that, this program is not entirely a donation,
right?
Because the landowner gets a substantial quid pro quo for his tax credits,
right.
Tax deductions. So.
He's willingly surrendering his property rights for...
He's trading his property rights for present-day benefits.
To an extent.
To an extent.
Now,
but doing it the way he liked to do it, he's not giving up that much.
There are other motivations, too, but that's certainly there.
Okay, so you know, we will permit him to have 100-acre lots.
So we have do we just need to say...
I think we've already just a general consensus of the board.
We don't need a motion.
I don't think you need a motion, but as long as I understand, the consensus of the board is to permit.
To permit, yes, sir.
That's correct.
That is correct. So that takes care of unfinished business. Do we have any other new business for the board?
One quick note. I'd just like to recognize Mr. McMahon, and with a little help from Mr. Stevens, all the new sound system actually has worked pretty well. You can hear in the audience now better. Our recordings are much better. So you've got external speakers that we have to do. We're doing independent of the courtroom, but that way when you travel too, you'll have a better system now. And they've done a lot of work on trying to get this set up, and you can actually hear everyone now. So,
very good. Very good. Thank you, Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, John.
Any other items of new business for the board? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and move into the second round of public comment. Again, please remember to keep your comments directed to the board within 5 minutes and on topic. Anyone wishing to address the board? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the second round of public comment. Is anything else for the good of the order?
Yeah, you know, we had the an overview of the PACE program, and the one reason why I kind of wanted that is because they may eventually have satellites placed in certain areas, medical satellites. And the other thing is, when I look over the audience, I see all these very, very young people. But taking care of the elderly is going to be different than with the PACE program. You know, and I took care of my mother. I took her to the arthritis person, the kidney person. I took her to her eye doctor. I took her over here. I took her over there. This is a one-stop place. And they are also building housing around the area for 55, more of assisted living. It's going to be a comprehensive, all-inclusive way of caring for the elderly. And so you people who are rapidly, some of us, and slowly, some of us, moving into that age.
No, damn it, no.
You're going to be so happy with
you're
this.
On your why are you right looking? Who are you
it's
looking
like a whole life.
I'm looking at all these people.
It'll go by just like that.
And you will be so very happy. That your daughter don't have to drag you out in the car.
Are you speaking for yourself?
I have daughters. Y'all got the gist. Didn't
I have
you get
daughters.
The gist? Did you get it?
Mrs. Booker, okay. I have daughters, and I think they deserve it.
That's right. They deserve to be tortured.
I appreciate it.
Put up with you.
Hearing no further business. We have a motion to adjourn.
Motion.
Motion is made by Mr. Weaver, second by Mr. Chester. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Good night, Detroit.